34, and tonight we are discussing March the 8th through the 14th of 2004. That's right. We have reached the aughts for the first time on this show. And it was a very special occasion when we have a very special guest for that occasion. But anyway, first off, before we get to that, we go to my co-host, as usual, David Bixenspan. Bix, how are you doing this week?
Not great, considering I learned the other day that I did not write Dylan's favorite pro wrestling article of 2016 so far.
Well, the year is still young, so maybe you have a chance to write a new article that may be even better than Dylan's favorite article of 2016. And this Dylan character we're talking about, of course, is my de facto co-host of Exile on Bad Street. Yahoo is the king of the podcast, the number one guest, the Tony Randall as in the podcast world. Dylan Hales. Dylan, how you doing?
Charles Nelson Riley.
Charles Nelson Riley.
I'm doing great. I just want to note, Bix, that your piece for SB Nation may have done to SB Nation what Rob Feinstein's arrest or television appearance did to Ring of Honor. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah. SB Nation. Boy, I tell you, they're just now starting to recover from that one. And, Rob Feinstein, we'll be talking about him a little bit later in the show.
It could be worse, though. I could have written about, I don't know, Terry Taylor or something.
Yeah. You've had a lot of fun this week, Bix, with Hulk Hogan. So we'll talk about that again later as well. But
yes, and God rewarded me with a staph infection. So.
Yeah, well, I don't see how you can get a social disease from following the proceedings in the Hogan trial this week. Salaciousness.
So speaking of social and diseases, so earlier, so we're recording this on Friday. Earlier, did you see how, when I posted how a few of my tweets got faved by the official Pornhub account?
Well,
so then she asks me, oh, do you have a copy of the deposition that I was showing the pictures, the stills from, with the guy from their parent company. And so she follows me. So I followed back to DM the link. And she was like, oh, thanks. Here's a free 3-month premium code. I was like, okay, well, thanks.
Here's a picture of Hulk Hogan's thermos.
Oh my God! Oh, we could do a whole show on that. But anyway, we're in 2004, and we've been wanting to get in there, and just trying to find the right week to do it. And man, there's a lot going on this week, as this is WrestleMania week. As WrestleMania was early this time of year, it's March the 14th, so we hit it right at the end of the week. But the big news happened 5 days earlier, as Brock Lesnar gave his notice at the SmackDown tapings on March 9th in Atlantic City, and that his match against Goldberg 5 days later at WrestleMania would be his last match. Lesnar's decision to quit was based on a number of factors, as while he loved performing, he hated to travel, and he wouldn't be at home more to see his baby daughter. He told someone at Mania that, quote, he's young and healthy and wants to try something else, unquote, which is the NFL. Lesnar said that he didn't want to look back years later and wonder what could have been regarding the NFL, so he's trying now while he is still young. Lesnar said that he's not saying he would never come back to WWE, but he has been disappointed lately and he's leaving for now. Lesnar has definitely taken notice of his peers and how they are always injured and some crippled, so he wanted to get away while he was still healthy. Lesnar claimed that he told Vince McMahon 2 weeks ago that he was leaving at Mania because he wasn't happy with the schedule and the lifestyles, and 6 months earlier he was told him he was tired of being unhappy. Lesnar in 2002 told people that wrestling was the greatest job in the world, but 2 years on the road changed his mind completely. Brock had just signed a new deal with a high downside guarantee to keep him from leaving, but that backfired, and he had rubbed people the wrong way, thinking he was the locker room leader of SmackDown. There were also rumors that Brock was highly upset about losing his title to Eddie Guerrero, and then once house show business shot up with Eddie on top, it made him even more upset because he thought he deserved a long, uninterrupted title reign. He was also upset that he was working against Hardcore Holly on the recent South Africa tour, while Guerrero was working Kurt Angle. Brock breaking up with the mother of his child and then finding out there were no concrete plans for him after Mania made him miserable as well. But the veterans who didn't have the opportunities that Brock had didn't feel sorry for him in the slightest. They also expect him to come back because everyone else does. Now, Vince also had to rewrite SmackDown as he wanted Lesnar off the show until the final segment. Now, backstage during all of this, Brock's girlfriend, Sable, and Tori Wilson, who had been traveling partners on a promotional tour for Playboy magazine, got into a big shouting match where after 45 minutes, Jim Ross had to pull them both in a room for a meeting, and he came out looking exhausted. Tori had some heat with Sable to begin with, and then supposedly she made a crack about Brock quitting, and it set Sable off. Now, Minnesota Vikings head coach Mike Tice said that there was no tryout with Lesnar scheduled, nor has he even thought about it yet. But the Vikings and the Redskins have expressed interest in him. Brock's flirtation with the NFL is basically because of Stephen Neal, who currently plays for the New England Patriots, and was the guy who beat him for the heavyweight title in the 1999 NCAA tournament. Neal didn't play college football either, and tried out for the Patriots, then got a job, so Lesnar thinks he can do the same thing. Brock is also getting interest from MMA groups, but because Lesnar's under a long-term deal with WWE, he would have to negotiate a buyout to work anywhere else. Pride and K1 both have heavy interests, but it's doubtful he will go there. All right, Bix, there's a lot to go through here. And reading some of this stuff in retrospect, it's kind of interesting, isn't it? The guys that have been there said, oh, everybody always comes back. And, of course, Brock did. And the whole stuff with Sable and Brock being pissed off at Eddie. I mean, this is interesting stuff to look back at it now.
Yes. The whole thing was weird. I mean, now we know that the NFL thing was not actually, oh, that's Brock's dream, as much as he was trying to look for anything that WWE would let him leave to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that was in his book that was in?
Yeah. Yeah.
So the whole thing is just kind of, I mean, it's a little different from obviously how it was reported at the time. And then the Eddie thing, which also, if you read his book, he thought that the whole thing about how they were taking the title off of him because Eddie was so hot with the Hispanic fans was BS. He thought they were looking for an excuse to take the title off of him.
Yeah.
Which, that's a bit peculiar. I don't know if he was blind or deaf or possibly just racist, but either way, I mean, that was it for him for a long time, and I don't blame him for wanting to leave, though. I mean, the more you know about Brock Lesnar, he was just not a guy who was built to do this, as far as full time and flying everywhere and being around human beings. I wonder if he should have looked for a different avenue, and then because then you know the Vikings wanted to sign him, but to do play on their NFL Europe team, and
yeah,
because of the reasons he left, he wasn't going to do that.
Well, the main thing in reading stuff for this was the Vikings were hoping that he was going to drop weight, and they wanted him to be a linebacker because of his foot speed. But of course, he didn't, and you know, he tried as defensive tackle. But they thought he had a better future as a linebacker, so that was interesting to read that in hindsight. But Dylan, the whole thing with Brock was, and the plans for Mania after Mania included him going against The Undertaker on house shows, and Undertaker's back as a dead man, which we'll talk about, you know, when we get to WrestleMania. But he thought that, you know, he thought that since Undertaker left, that's why he thought he would become the leader of SmackDown. And now Undertaker's coming back to take over that position, and Brock, who had basically alienated everybody, and the only person that he was really communicating with other than Paul Heyman was Sable. So he's a man on an island. He's miserable. I mean, he put himself in this position, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is really interesting to read in hindsight because a lot of mythology surrounding Brock Lesnar because of what he would go on to do in the UFC, less so than what he actually did in the original run as a pro wrestler. That's not to say he's not freakishly talented, because I think you'd have to be an idiot to think that he's not. But you know, I think one of the common, you know, I mean, this is a guy who got into the Observer Hall of Fame this past year, for example. We're all voters in that Hall of Fame, all three of us. And he got in with like 75% of the vote, which is pretty darn good when you consider the fact that the threshold is 60%. I mean, that's a pretty impressive vote total for someone to get. And on top of that, he was in the hardest category to get in, or arguably the hardest category to get in, which is modern performers, in the sense that you're competing against a bunch of people who pretty much all the voters have seen at one point or another. And he kind of coasted in. And I think a part of the reason that he coasted in is because people don't even think about this run anymore. They don't. No. They don't like. People might say, well, he had good matches during this run, and I would absolutely not deny that. But they don't think about the fact that Eddie Guerrero was a better house show draw than Brock Lesnar. You know, like, yes. The alleged – like, I think the mythology of Brock Lesnar as a draw is actually pretty embarrassing when you actually go back and look at it. There's no evidence historically that Brock Lesnar's ever been a pro wrestling draw. Zero. It doesn't exist. Like, he's a guy that I think – is really exciting to watch, and he obviously has a natural aura to him that I think resonates with anybody who's a big time fan of wrestling. I would never ever argue against that. I think it'd be silly to argue against that. But I also think it's equally clear that when you actually look at the data we have available, why would the WWE have kept the title on Brock Lesnar? You know, like, there's no reason to have done it. He was not a guy that was moving the needle during this period. He hasn't really moved the needle since he's come back. Like, he's sort of a method, like, he's a figure that I think, because he is unique at both athletically, physically, and the way the WWE's protected him during this run, there's an assumption about his star power that's not consistent with the reality. Like, the reality just is not at all close to what the assumption about him is. And I think that's one facet of the story that's kind of is the fact that this, if you sort of read this and unpack this, it sort of destroys the notion of Brock as this guy who was super, like, was the next level when he walked out of the company or whatever. I mean, that's just not the case. If anything, he might have been on his descent whenever he decided to leave. The other thing that I think is worth mentioning real quick that I don't want to forget is, I wonder if Hotel California was playing in the background whenever Jim Ross walked out of the room exhausted with Tori Wilson and Sable. As we know from his tweeting, his recent tweeting history, that that's his lovemaking jam. So
you can check out any time you like. You can never leave. But I think that Lesnar leaving the WWE is what the beginning of his aura. This is the You think it's this is probably the lowest point of Brock, maybe, in the company, and he leaves, and that's what, and he goes, tries out for the Vikings, and that gets people intrigued in him. Then he marries Sable. He starts working in Japan. He gets that big ass tattoo. I mean, the myth of Brock Lesnar.
Wait a second.
What?
That work in Japan sure did not add to his mystique, though.
No, it got people into him, though. It added to his aura. People were interested in stuff.
Yeah. What I think it did is, I think it added to the idea of him being a person who was going to do whatever he wanted and was not going to abide by the sort of conventional wisdom of what you're supposed to do in the wrestling business. And I think that is something that a lot of wrestling fans in this era, in the sort of post-internet era, really respect. I think, as my cat rips up a box next to me, I think that that's something that a lot of modern wrestling fans really respect, is this idea that I'm not going to abide by all your stupid rules. I'm not going to give you the limp hand handshake backstage. I'm not going to do all this bullshit that you're supposed to do. Whether that is the right way or the wrong way to go about business, I tend to sort of think that there should be the middle, like, abide by some of those old customs, but not to the point where it's absurd. But Brock, I think, was a guy that, like CM Punk, oddly enough, who has a lot of respect with a certain segment of the hardcore fan base, because he was seen as somebody that just said, fuck those rules. I don't care about them. They don't apply to me.
Yeah, that's exactly true. So, yep. And now we know what has happened since then. So, interesting to see what was the mindset at the time among the Sheets. And boy, I tell you this, you talk about Meltzer and his feelings for Brock. If you read the Torch from this era, totally different. Boy, they rip him up. So, you know, we talk about biases. And God bless Dave, but, you know, everybody has their biases. And there was definitely a different tone of the reporting of this whole situation compared to between the two major newsletters. So if you don't have a subscription to the Torch, go there to the website. And if you do, because if you have a subscription to, well, it's not up on the Wrestling Observer website, but he can make up this very interesting dichotomy. Just put that well. All right, moving on. Raw tapings the day before in Bridgeport, Connecticut at Harbor Yard, 7,000 sellout. Kenzo Suzuki makes his debut in a dark match, beating Nick Densmore. Travis Tomko and Kevin Ferdy beat Mike Mayo, which is Mike Cruel, and Horseshoe. Then you have Sunday Night Heat tapings, Rico over John Pinzaro, Val Venus over Kevin Phoenix, Spike Dudley over Lance Storm. Sounds interesting. Raw, you had Kane come out, set their match at Undertaker. Listen, this is the thing. This is 12 years ago. When you read these matches, it just sounds like it's forever. Mark Jindrak, Garrison Cade, Rene Dupree, and Rob Conway defeated the Dudleys, Rob Van Dam, and Booker T. Then you had Chris Jericho trying to trail Trish Stratus, so he loved her. But Christian jumped him and told her that Jericho was flat on his back, which is a position she should be used to. Todd Grisham made his debut interviewing The Rock, and Dave said that he looked like a short, skinnier version of Dean Cain. Then we had a handicap match between Randy Orton, Ric Flair, and Batista over the Hurricane and Rosie in 125 with Batista pinned Hurricane with a Batista bomb. Revolution beat him down. Orton cut a promo and Foley in The Rock. Chris Benoit defeated Matt Hardy with a cripple crossface in 1:38. And Jim Ross interviewed Benoit in the ring, interrupted by Shawn Michaels. Triple H came out. Triple H cut a promo on both men's egos would only serve to keep the title around his waist at Mania, in a promo that went way too long.
Shocking.
Yeah. Molly Holly pinned Lita at 2:22 with a roll-up and holding onto the ropes for leverage after avoiding a clothesline. After the bout, Victoria, wearing what Dave said was a ridiculous hot outfit, made the save, sending Molly to the floor. Dave also said that Lita had the "I'm doing a job" face. Yeah, she did. Austin then came out and said he was going to SmackDown and get his ATV back, and that he didn't like Goldberg or Lesnar. Steven Richards pinned Chris Jericho in 2:34 by reversing the Walls of Jericho.
Okay, well, Chris, first of all, I'd just like to note that for authenticity's sake, I've decided to use 2004 technology for the rest of the show. And I've gone to a very, very early handheld phone model. But I guess the biggest difference between Raw now and Raw then is, besides the obvious difference, which is the fact that Raw is 3 hours now and it was 2 hours then, I think the most immediate difference that stands out to me is the fact that nowadays Raw regularly has 10, 15, 20-minute television matches involving people that we sort of perceive as being good wrestlers, even if the product and the writing kind of sucks. You can almost always count on at least one match being decent or better, whereas on this show, there's not a single match that's longer than 5 minutes. So even though there's a lot of talented wrestlers on this show, there's really no opportunity to see how talented they actually are, because there's pretty much nothing that they're given and nothing that they have to work with that could be anything special during this time frame. I think it's, you know, I think now we sort of look at the modern era and complain about the writing and complain about the errors that people, you know, make backstage and like how screwed up the product is and all this other crap that's sort of like, and a lot of that I agree with, and I'm as big a critic as anybody. But I think it's worth noting that this period of Raw, 2003-2004, with Triple H on top in the Evolution stable, is, and to my mind, the worst television program in the history of pro wrestling. I think it's worse than TNA Impact at its absolute worst. It's just awful garbage week after week. Like, a bunch of talented people that have no ability to show how talented they are, 45-minute long Triple H promos that are boring as piss. Like, just awful, terrible TV that's just complete garbage. And for all the complaint about this year's Mania build and sort of how erratic and ridiculous it can be, and I don't even disagree with that, by the way, but I think if you look at this show and realize that it's the go-home show for WrestleMania, I don't see how you could realistically, seriously argue that this show that we're talking about is, you know, would be worse than what we've recently had on WWE television in 2016. I mean, this is there's nothing about this show that sounds intriguing. I mean, I guess you could argue, well, it's got The Rock and the segment with Foley and all that, but, you know, so what? Like, the whole rest of the, other than The Rock just being The Rock and Foley being Foley, before the period where he was completely overexposed and, you know, other than that, this is a pretty dire-looking show, at least on paper.
Yeah. It's those shows are interesting to read, like I said, read back in retrospect, you know, to see, you know, who was on the shows and how they were booked. The Chris Jericho, Trish deal, I had totally forgot about that angle. You know, the I Love You, build all that build, and then what would happen at Mania. I mean, it was hilarious. But, Biggs, what are your thoughts on anything on this show that catches your eye here?
I kind of think about what Dylan said in that I don't know if I ever found myself completely ever hating a life during those shows like I do, like you do during a lot of the Raws in the last couple of years. Although I don't know if they'd be as watchable without IRC chatting with you and you calling Batista Lee Stone all the time. But
yeah,
I mean, I don't know. But I mean, yeah, you don't have the long matches, and there was a lot of terrible things, you know, the Triple H in his suit and with his and that whole thing. And but I mean, there are part of it that sort of feel better if just because it's shorter. I don't know. I mean, it's not like either on the whole is good. I mean, I guess having longer matches makes it better now, and that usually the longer matches are really good to great. But I don't know. I mean, the one thing that was really the highlight at this time was the whole Jericho Christian Trish Lita thing, and
yeah,
they did a really good job with that. Certainly better than Jericho's work as of late, to say the least.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, this was. Well, you also have to remember they're building up a 5-hour pay-per-view.
True. And things are about to change, too, because they're doing 2 weeks later, they're going to do the whole total roster reshifting of the draft lottery. But, coming up.
And also, this was really – another thing that's worth considering is this was really one of the last years of what I would call the old Mania model. Because this – you know, Mania, which, of course, we're not quite at, was not in a dome yet. So
no, it's MSG.
This is before – what I would call the modern WrestleMania era. So I think some of the priorities on television may have been different, at least in part because of that as well.
Yeah. Yes. And although they had been doing dome WrestleManias for a couple years and then they went back
to
the Garden.
Yeah, they did it like the year before.
Although, right, because their strategy, I mean, it changed a couple times. So they did 17 through 19 were stadiums. Yep. Then 20 through 22 were arenas, with the idea being that in the top three, that they wanted to run the top three markets, especially, you know, and obviously 20 was going to be New York, but then they did LA and Chicago, big being the other two of the top three markets, and the best venues there are the regular indoor shed arenas. And then they wanted to go back to Detroit for – well, I'm trying to remember because Detroit did make a bid. So was it that Detroit made a bid and that's where they got the idea to do the anniversary?
That's where it all basically started after that.
Right.
And it's a continuous deal.
Right. Detroit kind of started the modern WrestleMania. Well, WrestleMania 20 had a little bit of a contribution though because it was the first one with the modern Hall of Fame.
And we'll talk about that in a few minutes.
But right, and then 23 being at Ford Field was the beginning of the whole bidding and the stadiums and all that, and then it takes further shape the next year in Orlando because of
grows connections with the Undertaker streak. It grows with the Undertaker streak too. So.
Right, and
all that tied in.
Also, as we'll talk about later, this is a big year for the ancillary stuff because this is the first year that you have the ROH show.
Yeah. Yeah, that's much later on the show. Let's go to SmackDown first. Tapings the next night, March 9th, in Atlantic City at Boardwalk Hall in front of 6,000. Kenzo Suzuki pinned Billy Gunn in a dark match. Bradshaw over Horseshoe in a dark match. Velocity taping, Shannon Moore over Paul London. Chuck Palumbo over Orlando Jordan. Hardcore Holly over Albert. SmackDown starts with John Cena pinning Rhino with the FU. Then you had Rey Mysterio Jr., Ultimo Dragon, Billy Kidman, and Sho Funaki over Jamie Noble, Tajiri, Akio, and Sakota. when Mysterio got the pin. This was supposed to be Mysterio versus Jamie Noble. Turned into a tag match. Another wrestler interfered. Chavo Guerrero Jr. and Sr. did commentary for the match. Then we had Eddie Guerrero pinning Shelton Benjamin. Kurt Angle came at ringside and had a stare down with the champion afterwards. Big Show defeated John Walters and Arch Kincaid in a handicap match where John Cena made the save, stole the belt, posed with him. SmackDown Tag Team Champions, Rikishi and Scotty Too Hotty, think about that, defeated Doug and Danny Basham in a non-title match. Then your main event segment, the entire SmackDown roster came to the ramp as Lesnar and Heyman rode out on Austin's ATV. Austin followed in his truck. None of the wrestlers touched him, which went against Heyman's orders. Show got in front of him, but let Austin buy him. He grabbed the ATV and drove it off before brawling with Lesnar, where he posted him, bringing out the juice. Lesnar tried to get Austin in F5, but Austin got out. Lesnar left Austin in the ring to drink beer. Now, you can definitely tell that that they were – Vince was definitely, you know, trying to turn the heat off of Brock for sure in that segment. But, Dylan, you know, compare the SmackDown and Raw shows here. You know, what do you think one was sounded better, or what do you thought about this show?
Well, I think the most immediate and obvious thing, and I mean, this is to be fair, this is a bias that I had at the time, so it's not as if this is inconsistent with what I would have thought then. But I think the most obvious thing is that there's a lot of guys on SmackDown who I would consider to be very good wrestlers. And it's clearly a show that is sort of influenced by, I don't even know what term you want to use for this. Like, I hate to use the term cruiserweight wrestling because in 2016 that means a totally different thing than it meant in 1996. But it's clearly influenced by that sort of smaller working man style of wrestling that sort of evolved out of the WCW cruiserweight division in the late 90s and out of what ECW was doing with Tajiri and Super Crazy and then sort of became the modern ROH independent scene. So it's clearly, I mean, that's the most obvious thing, I think, just from immediately looking at the results, is that this feels like a show that is more in keeping with that. Even with stuff like, you know, Rikishi and Scotty Too Hotty and the Big Show on it. I mean, it's just a show that's, I think, more consistent with that sort of thing. The other big takeaway, I think, is the fact that, you know, SmackDown had a go-home angle for WrestleMania that, whether it was at least partially done to undermine Brock, I mean, sure it was, but also I just think it's the fact that it actually had a go-home angle for Mania. Like, most years nowadays, they don't even use SmackDown at all. Like, they do that, they do nothing with SmackDown at all for the SmackDown before Mania whatsoever. I actually think it's going to be very interesting to see what they do this year, actually, now that I think about it, because they've kind of sort of tried to position SmackDown as, while it's still a B show, at least a little bit more relevant than it used to be in terms of storyline development.
They're doing the same thing again this year, where they're taping SmackDown after, I guess sometimes it's been before, but they're taping it the same night as the Go Home Raw, and, you know, it's only a few matches with inserts from
Access.
Well,
see,
from
to me, that's a terrible mistake. I think that's especially being on USA, because to me, it's a wasted opportunity. If you have one more show where you can really do something with your storylines or, like, hammer something home, which they clearly at least tried to do, I think, to a degree on this SmackDown here, you should do it. You should take advantage of that. You know, and I mean, that to me, that's the big difference, really, if you look at this, is that not only does SmackDown have its own storylines going on, of course, because this is the brand split era, but it also feels like a show that is distinct but also relevant. Like, whereas now, I mean, they've done a little bit nowadays to I think make SmackDown a little bit more relevant than it was in its last period before it moved to USA, but It's still not what it should be.
And that may change after Mania. Who knows? It depends on how the Shane McMahon stuff goes on. But the thing, Bix, you know, we talked about the draft lottery just a few seconds ago. I mentioned it. And there's a lot of nervousness among the talent right now because of the SmackDown guys. Is most of them are very happy that, you know, they're on SmackDown, while the Raw guys are kind of, you know, wanting to get off Raw. And, you know, I guess that this could be all attributed mainly to Triple H. I mean, what do you think about that whole deal that was going on at the time.
Well, let's see. So I'm trying to remember. I mean, I guess I'll scroll back up to look at our Raw results to get an idea of who our crew is at this point on Raw and Heat and all that. So let's see. Wait, so yes, that's Bridgeport Raw, including Dark Mansion. So we've got Kenzo Suzuki, Tom. Oh, no, I guess some of these are OVW guys. So Rico, Constantino, Val Venus, Spike Dudley, Lance Storm, Jindrak, Cade, La Resistance, Dudley's, Rob Van Dam, Booker T, Evolution, Matt Hardy, Benoit at this point, the women's title. I mean, they honestly don't have a bad collection of wrestlers on Raw at all.
They have the names. They have the name guys.
I mean, but they have
SmackDown had the smaller guys.
But they have a lot of very good to great workers on Raw too. They just were not being used well.
Yeah, well, there's a reason for that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you can understate the reign of terror that was Triple H and Evolution.
Like, yeah, that was terrible.
It really is. Like, you know, people who know me around the Twitterverse and the online wrestling world or whatever probably know me as one of the foremost Triple H haters. But even I will say that up until really the quad injury, as a worker, you could find as much good as bad, really. I mean, and maybe even more good than bad, at least in some ways. And he was not, even though he was pushed down the throat of everybody in 99 and 2000 and it got a little ridiculous, at least it was like fresh ridiculous and it was somewhat compelling and you thought there was a chance that this guy was eventually going to be one-upped and have his ass kicked. So there was sort of something to root for. But this period, oh my God. Like, I mean, this is really the period where I think like the 2003-2004 years, like those 2 years, I think are the years that sort of define the hyper insecurity and like soul crushingly boringness of that, you know, was Triple H at his absolute worst.
The excesses I think of Triple H.
Yes. I think it's really, really hard to to me, it's almost impossible to defend him as a character, television presence, or even as a backstage figure during this period. Like, you can defend aspects of him in the years before that relatively easily. And even after that, you know, because, I mean, he had, like, the good series with Flair, for example, like, the very next year. But, God, 2003, 2004 was bad. And it really brought down the Raw brand in a major, major way.
And maybe some of the best stuff he did during that period was the stuff that he was so obviously cosplaying Harley Race and Ric Flair that you couldn't get past it. Remember when he did the "Somebody Take the Damn Money" promo like a month and a half or whatever it was after the Flair DVD came out?
Yeah, yeah, he was tall. I mean, he had the Ole Anderson facial hair going on. I mean, he was something else in his time period, but. Let's move on to the Hall of Fame, which Vix mentioned. This is the first real big year for the Hall of Fame.
Well, they had the Hill, sort of.
Well, yes. It was the first one that was released on DVD. So, I mean, that's what I'm saying. It was the first big year for the Hall of Fame.
Well, this was the year they brought it back, but they didn't move it into an arena for at least a few years. They did it in theaters for a few. And this was this even a theater or was it more of a ballroom type of thing?
No, it was at the Hilton, and they had fans in there. They drew like 2,900 fans, or people, 2,900 people. So they had fans in there as well. But it was the first one released on DVD, so that's the first time you ever saw it. Saw a true ceremony. You see clips and stuff on television, but honored this year was Jesse Ventura, Vanessa Morocco, Tito Santana, Superstar Billy Graham, Big John Studd, Pete Rose, Sergeant Slaughter, Greg Valentine, Bobby the Brain Heenan, Harley Race, and the Junkyard Dog. Now, it went 5 hours and almost didn't have Graham as he was in the hospital all day long on March the 12th with intestine problems, but he showed up and was in good spirits.
I remember correctly, weren't the stories that he had some kind of like thing bursting out of his stomach, alien style type of thing going on?
Yes. It was pretty nasty. But Biggs, I mean, what did you think about this ceremony? I thought that this may have been Heenan's last great, you know, moment as far as, you know, before all his problems.
Well, he had already had the cancer, though. I mean, he was recovering from... Well, this was when the cancer was in remission, but before he discovered the damage that had been done to his jaw.
Yeah. But he was so great here.
Oh, he was fantastic here. And, I mean, we didn't see it, but apparently live, it was almost ruined, though, because they went with Lanza to be his inductor, and Lanza spent...
Joe like, Lanza?
What? No. Blackjack Lanza to be his inductor, and apparently he went like 20 minutes telling all like embarrassing Heenan being drunk stories to the point that Heenan's daughter was crying, and I think they had it down to like 30 seconds to a minute on the DVD.
Yes, very short. And Jack Lanza is one of Heenan's best friends, so I guess he thought that was pretty cool or something. I don't know, but it was interesting to watch. I mean, I remember buying the DVD, and I really enjoyed seeing it because, like I said, never seen it before. But, Billy, what do you think about these inductees? I mean, this is mainly all WWF, mainstays. But Pete Rose is a name that sticks out. He's the first big celebrity inductee. And the rumor was at the time that Bob Backlund, who was supposed to be inducted in this class, refused to be inducted with Pete Rose. What do you think about that?
I think at the time that I actually kind of have respect for the idea of Backlund or anybody else being like, this is ridiculous, I'm not going to do that. Later on, I think, what difference does it make? Because they'd established that precedent, and they were obviously going to continue to run with that no matter how absurd it was. So with time, I think, like, resisting that idea becomes a little bit sillier because it's like, okay, I mean, the Hall of Fame is what it is. I think we all sort of know that. I think it has value, but it's not the joke I think that some people would have you believe it is, in the sense that it's not like, oh well, it's a it's completely stupid and dumb and it's just Vince. There's clearly, I mean, the fact that Bruno's in and that Triple H or whoever went out of their way to like do that, because it tells you that even to the company, they do see it as having some value beyond just purely picking their guys for PR reasons. I mean, you could argue that the Bruno induction was a PR thing, but I think to be perfectly frank, who really gives a shit at this point? I mean, it's not like there's thousands of Bruno Sammartino fans that were anyway, I personally think that to me, it's funny that Ventura and Billy Graham went in the same year. you've got basically like the most egregious ripoff of a gimmick you can think of, besides guys that are doing an overt ripoff, going in the same year as the guy he's ripping off, which is amusing. And I mean, yeah, Heenan's speech, I think, is probably still my favorite of any of the Hall of Fame induction speeches that have been done at the Hall of Fame. The line about Monsoon at the end is like, is really brutal and like super sad and like one of the most authentic things I think that probably has ever happened in one of those Hall of Fames. So it's a good induction ceremony thingy, largely because of Heenan.
Yeah, and Ernie Ladd I thought was great there. Talking about JYD, and just a really fun ceremony.
Yeah.
Now, let's go to me.
Well, I did want to mention, also, Harley Race, though, this is the beginning of them saying that it's a wrestling-wide Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And Backlund, I was there when he did get inducted, which was when they came back to New York 9 years later, which was insane.
Well, he is insane.
I know, it was even more... It was even weirder seeing it live, if that makes sense.
And the one thing I'll say, though, about this Hall of Fame, though, is I enjoyed this setting for the Hall of Fame more than I enjoy the major arena for the Hall of Fame.
Oh, you mean because you can actually enforce the dress code?
That, and you don't have a lot of fans. Doing that stuff. That this is more of a respectful tone for it. So I think I wish they would go back to something like this, but it's too far gone now.
By the way, have they ever actually tried to enforce the dress code? Like, have we ever heard of fans wearing t-shirts and stuff getting kicked out of the Hall of Fame?
No. They won't do it. All right, next night, Mania, MSG, 18,500 paid sellouts. John Cena wins U.S. title from the Big Show with the FU after using brass knuckles, star and a quarter. Raw tag champs, Rob Van Dam, Booker T defeated Cade and Jindrak, Dudleys, and La Resistance. Five-star bra splash on Booker after Booker getting a scissors kick on Conway, star and a half. Christian pinned Chris Jericho at 14:56 with a roll-up using tights for leverage after Trish Stratus accidentally raked Jericho in the eyes. After the match, Trish slapped Jericho and left ringside with Christian. So there's your big angle. 3.5 stars. Randy Orton, Ric Flair, and Batista defeated The Rock and McFoley in a handicap match at 17:09. Orton pinned Foley with the RKO as Foley prepared to apply the Mandible Claw. Foley's first match in 4 years. Rock's first match in 11 months. 3.75 stars. Torrey Wilson and Sable defeated Stacy Keeler and Jackie Gayton in a Playboy evening gown match. Torrey pinned Jackie with a roll-up, 2:41. Prior to the bout, all four women disrobed to their bra and panties while after the match. All right, then we have a Cruiserweight Gauntlet match. Chavo Jr. defeated Nunzio, Shannon Moore, Rey Mysterio Jr., Sho Funaki, Ultimo Dragon, Jamie Noble, Billy Kidman, Tajiri, and Akio in 10:38. You have all these guys and you only go 10:38. That's hilarious. 2.5 stars. Bill Goldberg pinned Brock Lesnar in 13:48 with a spear and jackhammer. After the bout, guest referee Steve Austin hit the stunner on Lesnar before doing the same to Goldberg, star and a quarter. SmackDown Tag Champions Rikishi and Scotty Tuhati defeated the Acolytes. Team Angle, Shelton Benjamin, Charlie Haas, and the Bashams in 6:05 when Rikishi used a sit-down splash, star and a quarter. WWF Women's title, Victoria pinned Molly Holly in 4:56 while reversing a neckbreaker submission hold to a backside, black side. Molly had her head shaved bald after the match, 1 star. WWE World Champion A. Guerrero pinned Kurt Angle, 21:30, inside cradle using ropes for leverage after going angle lock by lacing his boot, 4 stars. Undertaker with Paul Bearer pinned Kane with a tombstone, 6:56. Taker's turn after 4 months. Bearer's surprise return after nearly a 4-year absence, star and a quarter. And your main event, Triple Threat, Chris Benoit defeated Triple H and Shawn Michaels to win the title in 24:07 when Triple H submitted to the Crippler Crossface. After the bout, WWE World Champion Eddie Guerrero came to congratulate Benoit. And following the telecast, Benoit's family came out to celebrate the victory as well. Pro Wrestling Illustrated and PW Insider Match of the Year, 4.75 stars. Yeah, that's Dave's rating. Dylan.
No, that's not what I was laughing at. Never mind.
I know what you're saying. That's Grant. That's our buddy Graham. All right, Dylan, what are your thoughts on this card?
Well, I actually haven't gone back and watched this show in a long time. And I think part of the reason why is that the most powerful and sort of enduring image from this show, and I think the thing that most people will remember from it, is, of course, the last moment after Benoit wins the title when him and Eddie Guerrero embrace in the ring. And that's kind of something that I don't think a lot of wrestling fans don't even want to think about a lot anymore.
Well,
it's a tragedy. It's a sad tragedy.
Although
really
too
is.
Many fans do.
There
certainly are. But it's not something that, like, to me, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, I rewatch footage all the time. I'm probably, one of the people most likely to rewatch stuff that you'll ever talk to. But I I'm not even somebody that's like militantly opposed to the idea of watching Chris Benoit footage, even though I almost never do. But the idea of going back and watching that match, especially, it's like, no, I don't want to do it. it's a moment, like everything about it that was celebrated at the time feels like a lie. And I just can't imagine like going back and embracing it with an open heart at this point in my life. I think there are a lot of interesting things on this card too. Sort of looking back with 2016 eyes, like the fact that the women end up in their bra and panties at the end of the match, like that's so far removed, even with some of the shit that the WWE still does as far as making everything sure everything is super sexualized and some of the catty portrayals of the divas now. That's still, I think this still is so far removed from what we would ever see now on TV.
Well,
that I think it's kind of.
Here's what I.
You don't agree with that?
Well, no, it's not that I don't agree. No, it's that I have something to add to it. I'm trying to remember if it was this or a different one, like if it was something during the invasion. I just remember, and maybe it was this, that there was one of these matches where it, for some reason, and maybe, I think it was this one because they all of a sudden, they just voluntarily do it at the end.
Yeah.
It felt really weird and much more prurient than they had in the past.
Well, they did submit these matches. They run together. I mean, they were doing them almost every week on television for a while.
Right. And I also,
yeah. I mean, it became a staple. Yeah.
And well, and I always also thought it was weird and maybe too obvious that they eventually just abandoned the whole like evening gown match conceit and just called it a bra and panties match. But
yeah, it was ridiculous. But really, Dylan, I really want to get your take on the Lesnar Goldberg deal because the fans made that whole segment.
Before I get there, I do want to comment on Eddie versus Kurt Angle.
Okay, sure.
Because
yes.
I think that's a match that kind of gets lost, and I think it's a match that, I mean, I remember watching the show live and really enjoying that match, but also being really frustrated by that match because what we didn't cover, because it happened, I think, a little bit out of this time period, I think it was the SmackDown before the last SmackDown, if I'm not mistaken, like, Eddie wins the title, he's got this match, and he ends up wrestling, like, I think he wrestles Rey Mysterio on TV, or it might have even been after Mania. But Rey Mysterio had, like, had to win a tournament to wrestle Eddie on the show, where he wrestled, I think, Shelton Benjamin in the Big Show in, like, back-to-back matches. And then Eddie went and wrestled, like, a 50-50 match with Rey, and it's a match that's, like, really great if you watch it in isolation. But within the context of the show, you're thinking, wait a minute, this little guy who's, like, the ultimate babyface just wrestled two people, and now Eddie's wrestling him even keel. And then if you look at how he was booked here against Angle, yes, he won, and he won clean technically, but he's presented as a guy who kind of just sort of had to mentally outmaneuver Angle because he's not as good as him.
Okay, it was a SmackDown on the 18th.
Yeah, and to me, that's like a really weird way to book a guy who you just had beat Brock Lesnar, whether there was interference from Goldberg or not. Like, it shows that while they did, in theory, have a commitment to the idea of Eddie Guerrero as the champion, they clearly didn't see him as somebody that you could really run with in a strong championship run, because I don't think there's any way you could argue that that depiction of him is very strong.
Well,
and that was one thing. I mean, you could say that he was sneaky and like that, and that it plays into that sort of craftiness. But I mean, to me, if you're pushing a guy who won the title in what was pretty obviously like presented as a monumental upset against this giant dude, and then his first, you know, couple of his first, you know, high profile matches are beating Kurt Angle because he was smarter than him, even though Kurt Angle is portrayed as vastly superior, and then beating Rey Mysterio on TV after Rey Mysterio wrestled two other guys and you wrestle him 50-50. I think it's pretty hard to make the argument that Eddie was presented as strong. Like, you can argue that he's presented as like crafty or sneaky or whatever, and that's how he gets his wins. And that, I think, is ultimately what they kind of did, at least at times. But to me, that is not the way he should have been. I mean, like, you have to heat somebody up more than that, I guess, is the way I would put it.
Well,
like,
he did beat Lesnar clean, though, because after the Goldberg interference, Lesnar kicks out, and then they start wrestling again as if nothing happened, and then they do the finish.
I think to say he beat Lesnar clean is an exaggeration, but I agree with you that Goldberg was not involved in the actual finish of the match. Like, you know, and I mean, that's a fair point. It's more, to me, it has less to do with the way Eddie won the title and more to do with the presentation of him in the immediate aftermath.
Well, when was the Big Show match? Was that before or after WrestleMania?
Ooh, that's a good question, and I don't remember.
Which one, Biggs?
That really, really good Eddie Big Show match.
I thought
it was before Mania.
Was it on SmackDown?
It
yeah, it was on SmackDown.
No, it wasn't before Mania.
When was it?
Eddie had a match with Paul Heyman before Mania. But,
it's not like I think they presented him as like an undeserving champion. In no way am I saying that. I just feel like
real quick, Eddie Big Show was in April.
Okay.
Yeah, I just feel like if you compare the way he was booked, like to me, if you compare him to the way, say, Benoit was booked, who, of course, this is the same time, like, you could argue that Benoit had his own issues with the way they sort of interjected extra parties into what was maybe supposed to be his coronation at WrestleMania. But Benoit wins the match clean with a submission finish. You know, and I just, to me, there's a big difference between the way those two guys were presented at that point in time. And as far as Goldberg and Brock, I mean, I haven't watched that in years, but it remains one of the craziest things. Like, watching it live was completely insane because the news broke, of course, in real time that Brock was leaving. But because it was a relatively late development, of course, it had broken late. This wasn't like we'd known for weeks and weeks and weeks that Brock Lesnar was going to be leaving WWE. So I think, and in a way, I kind of wonder if the reaction from the crowd would have been the same if the crowd had known, like, say, 3 months in advance that Brock was leaving.
Well,
or if it's, like, I think it's the city. I think, well, it's the city more anything else, where they were at.
And that the match was terrible.
Yeah, but it's the city more anything else. This is the beginning of Mania being, like, the smart fan
the
show.
Smart traveling loud.
Yes, and plus, I mean, we it's worth noting that Goldberg has basically done too. So
yes.
you like,
I mean, he was,
it's a complete lame duck match.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a complete lame duck match. You know what I mean? It's a match that has, like, no real, like, for all the complaints that we make nowadays, or some people make nowadays about part timers, and I've been as guilty of that as anybody. Those matches, I think, for the most part, the WWE's done a pretty good job of not making them feel like lame duck matches, even if you know the person's only in for one or two matches.
Right.
For the most part. Whereas this, I mean, there's no way out of this, you know, like, because you know that no matter what happens in this match, it's really not going to have anything to do with what's going on next. And I think Austin being there actually makes it worse, because I think for a lot of fans, it's like, why the fuck did Austin never wrestle either of these two guys? Like, it's like rubbing it in their face that Austin never had a match with either of the two of them, which I think... And, you know, to me, is like, if you were to ask people of the guys during the period where Austin was an active performer, what were the two people that might have been, you know, these might be the two guys that would come up. And Austin's right there, but not as a participant. I just think that probably added fuel to the fire.
Well, the one thing I'll say, though, is that I do think it would have been different if it was a better match, especially since at this point you would kind of expected a good match, because Goldberg in the WWF, to be honest, was actually pretty good. And Lesnar had been pretty great for a while. So when they came in and they had this absolutely abjectly terrible match, it was really, really easy to turn on under the circumstances.
You know, I have no memory of whether the match was even good. Like,
it was this bad stalling thing where they wouldn't touch, but it wasn't good stalling.
Gotcha. Like, I honestly have no memory of whether or not it was a match that the crowd turned on and was not going to
get. It wasn't. It wasn't good. Yeah, it wasn't good. You know, it's one of those matches that if you want to rewatch it, you only need to rewatch it just to listen to the crowd and watch Austin's reaction to the whole thing, because he is great during the match with his facials and his actions. But all right, Bix, what are you any thoughts on this card? Touching on stuff that Dylan talked about.
No, it's 5 hours long.
Yeah, it was a long, long show. Surely. All right. Now, let's move on to, of course, being Mania Week, they have a lot of WWE guys in the media. And Vince McMahon gave an interview to The Hollywood Reporter on March 9th, and there's some good lines in here. Vince claimed that 70% of the viewers for Raw and SmackDown were specifics of the brand, which Dave said, how come is it when he goes to house shows, he sees the same people? All right. Vince then said that regarding their deal with In Demand coming up, that they wouldn't settle for any less than their current deal, which is 45% of the take. Vince also said that pro wrestling isn't cyclical, which goes against what Linda said in the last conference call. Although he admitted that while they weren't on fire, the Hollywood studios lose millions between hits, and they are still profitable. This is the most interesting one to me. Vince was asked about the uses of his expanding tape library, and he said that they could do a digital TV channel, or maybe even VOD. This is 2004. Vince also noted that he didn't think the company had done a very good job of taking advantage of their international popularity, and he wants more merchandising and licensing deals overseas. And last question, Vince was asked about his on-air character, and he said that those days are numbered because at 59 years old, his days are numbered. Well, Bix, what thoughts about the some of these things Vince said here?
Well, when did Classics on Demand launch? Was it 04 or 05? Or even – it was not that long after this, was it?
06. I want to say 06, wasn't it?
Do I have to look?
Well, it could have been 06.
I'm thinking 06.
It definitely wasn't 2005 unless it was later in the year. Because I moved back to South Carolina in 2005, and it was not on the air then.
And that they
No, because remember they had that soft launch with the Only One Cable Company. Yeah, it was later in 2004, November 2, 2004.
Oh, okay. There was talk about
definitely
the TV
channel. We definitely didn't get here until 2006, I don't think.
Yeah, but they were actually talking back then about doing a TV channel. So
right. What it was that I think there was a time where they picked up – it was whenever they picked up Cox and then Comcast or whatever that were the big deal. Like I don't know which cable company you have, Dylan, but – it was one. I'm guessing it was one of those two.
My cable company never got it. What do you think about that?
Really?
Yeah. Yep. Never had it when I had cable.
Yeah, but now remember, I think the deal with Classics on Demand, they had talked about doing a regular channel, but they realized that because at that time, pushing subscription video on demand with the cable companies was a big deal. Now, not really, but then. It was, and they realized it would be a much cheaper way where they could still probably get on in a lot of places and the expense would be very low. And it was not a bad idea. I mean, eventually it just kind of settled around the same area and it never really grew, but they also never promoted it. So.
I don't think you
really know what the actual ceiling could have been because they promoted it so badly. But. I mean, I don't know. I mean, because then we look at, like, the network, they didn't even promote what right for the first
They don't promote the library. Really, all they promote is mainly your scripted shows and stuff like that.
Well, they don't promote the library at all, but even then, like, they didn't promote the network as a whole well for the first,
no.
I guess we could say 6 to 8 months would be the best way, something like that, 6 to 9 months.
Yeah.
That's fair.
What are your thoughts about any of the other stuff that he says here?
I liked the wrestling isn't cyclical thing contradicting Linda. That was impressive.
Well, that's not the first time I'm sure that he's had the opposite statements from Linda in anything. But,
Dylan, I like that his on-air career has slowly been winding down for 12 years.
Actually, when you say the thing with contradicting Linda... Were they – because I'm trying to remember whose Congress interview it was that said that the wellness program had nothing to do with Eddie Guerrero dying and then got – were they contradicted by each other or were they contradicted by someone else?
I can't remember.
Or was one of them? I feel like Vince said and then maybe Linda contradicted him or was maybe Linda and or Dr. Black or something. But
there was a lot of that going on though.
Yes.
Yeah, a lot of – Linda sometimes can be too truthful. So, Vince had to, pull out the BS meter, but...
Well,
Linda
eventually learned not to be too truthful.
My
favorite being saying that the family had been on food stamps after they went bankrupt. But it's not only that they weren't on food stamps, it was that she confused food stamps with some supermarket's local something stamps program, which was like their...
Probably S&H Green Stamps.
Yeah, it was S&H Green Stamps. That's what it was.
Yeah, which is not food stamps.
So what is it exactly? Is it just like a discount program or something?
You buy them and use them.
So it's like a gift certificate or?
Yeah, they haven't existed in like 30 years or more, but I remember when I was a little bitty kid. So yeah, it was a thing.
Did you get a discount with it though? Like you bought
for those of you that are 40 and over, when you listen to this show, clarify the S&H Green Stamps deal for us. Because
Piggly Wiggly had greenback stamps up until maybe probably even less than a decade ago down here.
Yeah, that was kind of the same, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And that means that, like, basically you get reward for the money you spend and then, like, with the greenback stamps, and then you turn around and can use the greenback stamps for other things. Like, both inside the Piggly Wiggly and with like other adjoining programs or, you know, things that they were connected to.
And they're most definitely so, food and stamps.
It would be like Linda claiming that, that some rewards program that they were a part of because they had money to spend was the same thing as food stamps, basically.
There you go. Now, Howard Stern mentioned on his show on March 9th that WWE wanted him for Mania, but he said the writers couldn't come up for anything entertaining for him to do. He said Vince asked him what he wanted to do, and Stern said that he doesn't exactly spend his days thinking about ideas he can do on a wrestling show. Plus, he said that he was asked for $1 million for the shot, and Vince said that he would have paid $10,000 at the most, and Howard wouldn't lower himself to a wrestling event for that little bit of money. Dylan, you think that $1 million is too crazy for Stern?
Not at the time. I don't know that they would have really gotten their money's worth out of it. I don't really think they got their money's worth out of any of the celebrities.
Well,
maybe the exception of Mayweather.
Trump.
Here's the thing.
Trump should be in the Observer Hall of Fame level guy. Like, not only that, he's still arguably the best heel promo in the world.
Well, the thing with Howard, though. His audience, he would have gotten his audience to buy the show if he was constantly promoting it.
Yes, probably, you're right. But I'm still, you know what, I don't know if that's right or not. I mean, I'm trying to remember, 2004, like, it's funny because 2004 is like the period where I was listening to Stern almost every single day because I lived in New Jersey at the time.
And I mean, this
is
already era.
Yes. Oddly enough, this is the era when I probably listened to more Stern than any other period of my life, just because of where I was living.
God help you.
But, when you're riding around in a box truck, with Latin King coworkers, I assure you that Howard Stern is much preferable to what the normal conversation would be.
Well, and also there was no Opie and Anthony on at this point either.
He might have been. I mean, he certainly was worth a hell of a lot more than $10,000. I wouldn't have done it either.
Yeah.
Of course, I also don't really believe Howard when he says that he was only offered $10,000. I think that's probably entirely false. But you know, who knows what he was actually offered? Or also, who knows how serious Vince even was? That's another thing. I mean, it could have been like Vince contacted him and kind of threw out a number, and Howard scoffed at it, and Vince was like, "Well, fuck it, I don't really need you."
Well, I mean, the $10,000 was the Hall of Fame payoff once they started. I don't know if it was yet, but once they started doing the Arena Hall of Fames, it was.
Yeah, but there's
right. I'm saying that means you're right.
Yeah. To me, they would have. What they would have offered him, I don't know. But
it
I
would have been more
I
than
mean,
Nick
there's
Bob
no
Bob
way.
About.
Yes. Yeah, it would have been more than $10,000.
Hi. Rick Flair was on ESPN's Cold Pizza. God, that show, on March 10th, where he was asked about the current steroid scandal in baseball, and he said that there was no steroid use in the WWE, with the company randomly testing employees, and they are absolutely prohibited. Dave said that if Flair got into his time machine, going back to 1992, he would be close to correct. Flair said that he had never seen anyone do steroids, but had heard rumors and said that, quote, if you can't get it done with your own abilities, then go home because you don't belong here, unquote. Bix, oh boy, this is so hilarious coming from Flair.
Well, especially since a few months later, Foley leaves the company, goes to ROH, and starts cutting promos all the time about how Flair says, and I paraphrase about how Flair and I paraphrase has to stick a needle up his ass to keep his tits from hitting the floor.
And my thing is, Dylan, in this whole thing is, who is Flair's, you know, biggest confidant in the company this time? Triple H, who, if you watched him in this era, is just dripping in steroids.
Oh, no question. Not only that, but Batista's right there in his stable, too.
Yeah.
Like, those two guys are, like, basically the living embodiment of steroids at this point in pro wrestling. I mean, there was periods during this era where Triple H was approaching Jeep Swenson levels of near death. Like, I can't – it's hard to imagine that – but,
Well, everyone was during this 2001 to like 2005 era, though. You look back, especially at some of the guys who stuck around a while.
Before Eddie died.
Yeah. Yep.
Look at Eddie and Benoit. Oh, my God.
Yes.
Well, they looked Yes, especially Benoit, because Benoit adding growth hormone to his usual cocktail, he looked just deformed.
Yeah.
No, didn't look deformed. He was deformed.
Yeah.
I mean, let's just be honest. Yeah. I mean, more than a look.
Angle was gigantic at one point. I mean, although, it was so unnatural.
Although Angle at that period was actually less scary than the Angle after his arm started to atrophy when he got off.
Yeah. Oh.
As far as looking.
Yeah, you're right, because he dropped.
Not that I'm
considerable difference.
Condoning steroid abuse.
But I mean, it would happen. There would be matches I'd watch where I'd be watching SmackDown and I'd be glad the show was taped because I'd be watching and some of the wrestlers had such scary like vascularity that I was worried that I'd watch them drop dead on TV if it was a live show.
Oh God, that's not a joke.
I'm not joking.
For people who listen to this and think that that's like, oh, you guys are just trying to be funny. I remember having conversations with you two and other people like on message boards and other places back then where people were literally like not jokingly saying, I'm seriously worried that I'm going to see one of these guys die on TV this week. I mean, when Angle has sort of created this alternative theory that as complete nonsense that he sort of, you know, faked injuries and other problems to get his release from the WWE. No, Kurt Angle was such a fucked up drug addict.
He's come clean on that, though.
I mean, he was such a fucked up drug addict during this period, and you know, going forward after this, that Vince McMahon was like, man, you're too fucked up for our company.
When Vince says that, you fucked.
Well, and they hired handlers for him, too. Like, how many times has WWE done anything like that before they even let him go? Like,
rarely, if ever. Andre may have been the only other guy I think of that had handlers.
Well, I mean, celebrity professional drug addict handlers.
But talking about Triple H, he was on ESPN Radio the next day, and when he was asked about steroids, he got nervous and stumbled around saying, no. And he said that in other sports, athletes got bigger, while in wrestling, the wrestlers got smaller. He said he can't speak for every work in the country, but said overall there was no problem, which Dave said is bullshit. Triple H said it's more than just appearance, because you need to be able to tell a story, have athleticism, and the right look, with steroids getting a bad rap. Because it isn't heroin. Triple H also liked talking about being the bad guy better because he gets the thrill of being better in the ring and creating new stars. Well, Dylan is right there. He says that steroids isn't heroin.
Well, that's true. You do put it in a needle and inject it, but it's not. It's not heroin. I guess that's a relevant point. You know, I mean, having one arm amputated is better than having two, for example. That's another thing you could argue. getting pegged by China might not be as bad as getting pegged by Nicole Bass. I don't know. Like, I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that are, like, I guess, better than something else. But I don't really know that that's a good argument for using them. So...
But you know what? That line there, though, is not nearly the most hilarious line. This whole deal is the line about creating new stars. Oh my God! I mean, I guess he was talking about, you know, Benoit. He created him. You know, he's about to create him. Now he's about to just tap out to him. He's gonna create.
He did a great job. He did a great job with Booker T and RVD and Chris Jericho and all those guys.
Yeah, hilarious. Bix, any thoughts about his comments?
Anything else? At least he had slimmed down a little bit from his 2002 vintage.
Remember the Scott Steiner matches where it looked like that both of them were about to just completely explode,
and then they're posed down.
Yes.
But the best part of the pose down was that, like, if you ever talk to bodybuilders,
about like pro wrestlers and guys like that. They always talk, make fun of them for not working out their legs and how they're just obsessed with the big upper bodies and all that.
It's all upper body.
And then Steiner and Triple H do this pose down where they're both wearing slacks.
Oh God. This era. Oh,
I mean, seriously, pull up a show from this era on WWE Network.
Yeah.
It will blow your mind how juice to the tits these guys are.
Yes. And speaking about juice in a different way, our final story this week is Sable is temporarily out of action at the Mania because one of her implants is leaking and she needs surgery to get a new one put in.
Wait, I gave you that line, and why didn't you say tits? I just said juice to the tits, and you went with juice instead of...
Well, juice and tits, same... Is there?
My question is, who the fuck taught Jim Ross how to work?
My thing is that you think Brock chewed on this a little too much, huh?
I mean,
what?
You'd think that Jim Ross would, you know, work the kind that would work safe, but I guess not.
Yeah, I'm gonna guess that. Wait, was the exhausted phrasing yours or Dave's? Chris.
Oh man.
No, I'm asking you. Was it yours or Dave's?
That was me.
Okay.
But yeah, that. Oh my God! Yeah. And I think that Sable even come back from this, Bix. I don't think she ever did. I think she was gone for good.
After
now.
The pay-per-view? I think so. Or did no? Wait, think, no. She stuck around. I think she stuck around a little bit until the lawsuit.
Okay.
Until Brock's lawsuit, right?
Yeah, I'm checking right now for sure. Yeah, she came back and worked in a bikini contest. She works Tori. Her last appearance.
Playboy spread was creepy.
Oh God! Yeah, her last segment was on July 22nd, 2004.
Where
Kurt Angle fired Tori Wilson, Dom Marie Sable, and Jackie Gata.
God.
For anyone who's never seen the Sable Tori Wilson Playboy, for some reason the talented photo artist Playboy decided that the best way to airbrush it was to make their faces as similar as possible and make them look like it was weird. Like, what?
Yeah.
I mean, as far as weird Sable airbrush, Playboy airbrushing goes, I guess it's not the weirdest thing that happened.
No, but I mean, the airbrushing machine on her and her spreads, I mean, they might as well have just retired it because there was nothing else you could do with it after that.
After the first one? You mean?
Oh, well, the first one and the second one. And a third one.
I think Dylan remembers what I'm talking about, but you don't.
I know. Well, I know one thing. The China one definitely needed to get rid of that one. But go ahead.
I know that Ric Flair would have been confused by the first one.
Oh, yes.
Now I still have that magazine.
Yeah, I still have that magazine here somewhere in my house. But, man, oof. That was a big deal at the time, her being in Playboy. Huge deal.
It was one of the biggest selling issues ever, wasn't it?
Yeah, but...
And then so was China.
She's a better, bigger draw than Brock.
And now let's go to something completely different. And we go to Japan. And we go to All Japan Pro Wrestling. And they announced that they're returning to network television after a four-year absence with a 30-minute weekly show every Monday night at 2 a.m. starting on April the 5th. Now, Dave considered this a coup for Keijimoto, as while a weak time slot, they got a deal where shoot style is the rage. And Kendo Kashin, who has disappeared lately, showed up out of nowhere at the Raw tapings in Bridgeport, Connecticut on March the 8th, but sent word that he was ready to come back and challenge Akira Hokuto to a match. Yeah, Kashin, at this time period, was doing this weird gimmick where he was just MIA, and here he is in WWE. And I remember the Japanese press at the time were really getting on it, saying he's going to be the next guy to jump and this, that, and the other. And, of course, that didn't happen. But
Wait. When was the whole Dragon Soldier B thing?
Yeah, he was doing that weird gimmick where he fucking sucked.
Remember that?
Him beating High and Gracie. Oh, my God. That was one of the worst things that happened to wrestling because it got him pushed. But, I mean, what are your thoughts on this this stuff, Dylan, from this section? The TV deal was it was a big deal for them to get back on television because All Japan was pretty much dead as a promotion, you know, 3 years earlier. Well, here they are back on national television.
What network was this, TV Tokyo?
TV Tokyo, yeah.
I mean, I guess on the one hand, you could look at it and say that it's impressive because of what you just said. And you know, post-split, All Japan is like a really weird company to follow because there were so many times, I think, where it looked like it was going to be the end, even now, I might add. And somehow it wasn't. And, like, it's just so different from the All Japan that, you know, I fell in love with as a tape trading geek in the mid-90s. It's just really, really hard for me to even see that as even being the same promotion, even now, even though it's been that way for far longer than it was the All Japan that I remember, which is kind of funny. Obviously the TV deal was significant for them. I think, you know, the sort of line about shoot style being all the rage is kind of the thing that jumps out as being relevant because while that's certainly true, I mean, it's funny to think about how you went from this period where you had the two basically big dog promotions in New Japan and All Japan, then the All Japan split happens, Noah kind of takes off, and then shoot style sort of are really more shoots than shoot style, and Enokiism sort of cannibalizes New Japan.
It's not shoot style, it's shoots, and then...
In fact, shoots kind of killed shoot style. You know, I mean, Rings was a promotion that could draw really well as a shoot style promotion. I mean, modern New Japan would fucking kill to get houses as consistent as Rings got at that level. And yet, you know, and then they started doing shoots, I guess, in 99 or 2000, up and down the card. They'd done some prior to that. And it just sort of slowly, with Enokiism taking off and all these guys that were New Japan guys and even other dudes working, well, not working, but shooting and usually getting their ass kicked. I mean, it really changed Japanese it took a decade for Japanese wrestling to recover, basically. And it still hasn't recovered fully, and it probably never will. In that context, All Japan doing what All Japan was able to do and getting a TV slot is probably more impressive than it might look now.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, you mentioned Enokiism. We mentioned how New Japan definitely changed. New Japan ran a big show on March the 12th at the Yoyogi National Stadium Gym, number 2. Announced 3,800 fans, drew 2,800 legit, which is a bad number for that building.
Now, wait a second. I just want to point out the results you pasted say no vacancy.
Of course. I know where I got this from.
But that's more than a – oh. It was this from a site run by someone who loves young lions running down the ramp?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, they claimed a lot of these no vacancies back then, but there were a lot of vacancies, let's say that.
We should make it clear, though. There's no vacancy, super no vacancy, and super no vacancy full house.
Exactly.
The only one of those you can be even a little sure that it's actually sold out is Supernova Vacancy Full House.
just so people have an English sort of Americanized context that you can compare this to, I would say this would be the difference between fans hanging from the rafters and fans literally hanging from the rafters.
Absolutely. Now listen to this card.
Does that make Vike Bobby Heenan?
oh, that's an old joke. Now, maybe five people will get. Oh, wow. All right. Here, listen to the car. We have Heat, which is Minoru Tanaka under a gimmick. Tiger Mask 4, Masayuki Naruse, Watara Inoue, beating Chushu Thunder Liger, Koji Kanemoto, Rasuki Taguchi, and Hiroki Goto. Heat using the Minoru special on Taguchi in 1433. Toru Yano beating Nafumi Yamamoto in 348 with the half crab. Osamu Nishimura beating Katsushi Takamura in 637 with Dragon Sleeper. Tatsutoshi Goto, Hiro Saito beating Makai Mask 1, Juji Harada, and Mitsuya Nagai 748. Goto using the bat draw suplex on the guy. And then listen to this match. IWGP Junior Heavyweight Tag Team Championship. American Dragon and Curry Man beat Jado and Gato in 1733 when Curry used the double arm face crusher on Gato. Then we have Hiroshi Tanahashi and
that
Yutaka
was a title
Yusuke.
Change, by the way.
Yeah, title change. Beat Tadao Yasuda and Kazunori Murakami in 745, where Tanahashi used a jumping elbow drop on Yasuda. Minoru Suzuki beat Scott Norton by TKO in 518. Yoshihiro Takayama beat Katsuyori Shibata in 334 by TKO. Manabu Nakanishi and Tenryu Nichiro beat Masahiro Chono and Yuji Nagata in 858, when Tenryu used the 53 years old on Nagata. And IWGP Heavyweight title, Kensuke Sasaki beat Hiroshi Tenzan in 1545 with the Volcano Eruption. And the main deal with that was Sasaki was a transition champ because Bob Sapp, who we'll talk about in a few minutes, won the championship on March 28th. So they had Sasaki do the job for him instead of Tenzan, which was a smart move for them, actually, because Sasaki wanted a New Japan guy at the time. He was a freelancer.
Well, and also, but Dylan, also go he got about as good a match as you could possibly expect anyone to get out of Bob Sapp.
Oh, yeah, that was the better matchup, for sure. But Dylan, look at this card.
Well, people should note, by the way, since we mentioned Bob Sapp here, I just want to say that Bob Sapp is, like, a huge draw in Japan.
Oh, we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Yeah,
just keep that in mind.
He has a main deal going on here. But you look at this card, and this is the New Japan of Inokiism era. I mean, what do you think? New Japan of 2004.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people who are fans of modern New Japan and maybe don't know a whole lot about that era. Although, to be fair, I think a lot of people have gone back and watched some stuff. So the New Japan obsessives of 2016 tend to be people who have a pretty solid understanding of their history over the last 15 years or so. But if you don't, I think the thing that sort of immediately stands out is that there's at least some of the guys that you'd be familiar with sort of littered across the card in various places. I think, to me, sort of the funniest thing is that fucking Tiger Mask 4 was still there back then in an irrelevant match that didn't matter. this guy has had the longest career under that gimmick by far of anybody who had that gimmick. And he's clearly the least talented of the four people who ever were under that hood. And he's just keeps doing, I mean, it's in a way, it's a real testament to him, I think. Like, it blows my mind. Like, anytime I go back and, like, I start sort of randomly looking at stuff on YouTube or whatever, and I occasionally will stumble upon a match of his, I'm like, God damn, I forget that he's been doing this for so long. So that's kind of a weird thing to, like, hone in on, but, I mean, you know, it stands out to me. Obviously, I think a lot of people will look at Danielson and Daniels being a tag team and having a match on the show as being kind of interesting, which I think is sort of novel. The match that I think, as an individual match, I think the matches that are most interesting are the two TKOs with Suzuki over Scott Norton and Takayama over Shibata, because that's your sort of Inokiism special, like these sort of shooters in a match, like. With that sort of that's pro wrestling, but it's not. And then, like, I don't know. I mean, it is pro wrestling, but it's presented within the context of the other shoot stuff that's going on in Japan at the time. And it's just a weird thing to do. But it was something that kind of was what they always did at that time in New Japan. You'd see that a lot on a lot of these shows.
Now, I'm looking at this and, well, the first thing I'll ask you this before I move into my thoughts. Do you remember what Zach Arnold's name for the Suzuki Takayama tag team was?
Oh God,
no, I haven't thought about Zach Arnold in a decade.
Yeah,
The Backyarders.
Oh yes, yes.
Which you may remember the why better than me. It was something having to do with their bumping ability or something?
Yes, he definitely. Yeah, he was. He did not think that they were as good as everybody else thought they were.
Now
he thought they were just offensive guys.
Right. So now, as I look at the rest of the show, I think my main takeaway is whatever happened to Takamura and Wataru Inoue?
Inoue retired due to injuries, and Takamura You know, he went to Mexico, came back. He got hooked up with Masada Nasawa and just pretty much became one of their guys for years after that. Became he was a member of Tokyo Gurantai.
Oh, that's right.
Okay. So he left New Japan and became, you know, just an indie guy.
Which is weird because you look back at this era, and especially because Tanahashi would kind of go up and down and was kind of inconsistent and all that. Takamura was the guy who was considered the real blue chip prospect in like 03-04.
Well, Blue Wolf was another guy that was a guy that people were looking at as like, okay, this guy could be a big time dude. I mean, Tanahashi was always the guy. Always the guy. But Kenzo Suzuki, who has just left, you know, he left earlier with right. World Japan with Choshu. But Kenzo Suzuki was really, if you look at that, he was the guy that they were willing to get behind.
He was the one who was going to be the star, and Tanahashi was going to be his partner.
Yes.
Right. Now, when with Tanahashi was the stabbing, though? Because that, of course, changed his trajectory for a while.
Oh, I want to say maybe the year after this. That's been a while since I thought about that. That was a big-time story.
Yeah. It's worth noting that his repeated failures as the top guy are somewhat changed his trajectory.
And speaking of Tanahashi...
Well, he wasn't pushed as the top guy for a while, though.
No,
he wasn't. But I do. As the guy who's the Tanahashi skeptic, I think it's my job to point out that regardless of how much of a star you think he is now, and to be perfectly fair, I think he's clearly the biggest star in Japan. And I've tried to make clear my position on that, and people don't want to hear it. But I do think it's worth noting that this is a guy who was also kind of the top guy for years, or at least one of the handful of top guys for years, when New Japan was at its absolute lowest point. Like, it's hard, I think, for people to conceptualize that, because for reasons that I think are questionable, he's been presented as the single guy who deserves the most credit for the business turnaround, which I think is debatable, even if you think he's the biggest star. But, you know, these were bad years for New Japan, and Tanahashi was pretty consistently one of the top two, three guys in the company during their absolute worst years in the history of the company.
Yeah. Now, on the 314 show in Kyoto, Heat and Takayama beat Chono and Kanemoto when Takayama went over Kanemoto. And after the match, Murakami attacked Takayama with Tanahashi making the save, and they formed a team to face the Makai Club, which that was a pretty fun little team while it lasted. But, the Makai Club was in like, going towards they're getting late in that run here of their dominance, but that was a big time deal. That's a Nokiism right there and a gimmick. You know, the Makai Club was the Noki's vision against New Japan. If you haven't seen New Japan versus Makai Club stuff, it's interesting to watch to see how that stuff went down. That's a whole nother show too. Talk about that feud. Anyway, moving on to Noah, Pro Wrestling Noah, who was probably at this time the number one promotion in Japan. Now, Noah officially announced on March, Noah officially announced on March 10th that Kenta Kobashi will be making his next defense of his GHC heavyweight title against Yoshihiro Takayama on April 25th at Nippon Budokan Hall. This officially eliminates Takayama from competing in the Pride Grand Prix tournament the same night at Saitama Super Arena. Also announced on 3/10. For the April 25th show was Mitsuharu Misawa and Yoshinari Ogawa defending their GHC tag titles against the GHC Junior Heavyweight Tag Champions, Kenta and Naomichi Marufuji. All right, Bix, that was a pretty good show. I mean, that April 25th show has some really strong matches. What are your thoughts about this?
Which, the April 25th show?
Yeah, I mean, those matches, how they when they happen.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, Kobashi and Takayama was fantastic. I don't remember. It's been a long time since I've seen it. I don't even remember that much specific about it, but I recall that it was maybe the best match of Kobashi's reign, or up there, wasn't it?
Definitely up there, because Takayama was awesome in this era.
Yeah, I mean, because the stroke was in the summer during the G1. Right? Yeah.
Yes.
Kobashi had that one match with Akiyama that I think was better. Maybe was that 2003? I can't even remember because I'm terrible with the Noah timeline.
I don't even remember if he had a title defense against Akiyama.
It might not have been a title defense.
Was it the one from, it was like December 2000 maybe, where he won with the Burning Hammer?
I don't think that's right. I'd have to, honestly, I'd have to, it's been so long since I haven't even tried to watch Noah in sequence in years. So,
yeah.
At the time, it was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it was like New Japan was, you know, in 2014. As far as like coverage in the Observer.
Oh, it was,
like,
yes, it was the promotion du jour for sure. There's no question about that.
And Kenta Marufuji, Dylan, I remember, you know, the talking to the Noah fans at that time period. I mean, Noah really didn't have any top young heavyweights. Like, I mean, they had more Shima and Rikio, but they,
not yet.
You could tell they weren't guys that was seen to be that could have been the guys to you know, anchor the company. Kenta Marufuji were. And there was a lot of Noah fans that were thinking that Noah would probably have to turn into more of a junior heavyweight style promotion to build around these guys. And then we saw what would happen down the line. But what are your thoughts about this era of Noah?
I think Noah was pretty darn good for about a 4-year period. And this would be right in the middle of that 4-year period. You know, once they did sort of switch over to the Kenta Marufuji stuff, like, to me, like, the last year of Noah where I really enjoyed a lot of it was probably 2006. But once they fully went 100%, like, sort of all, you know, behind those two guys, the promotion lost a lot of interest for me. Kenta is somebody who I like Kenta. I'm not like an anti-Kenta guy, but I'm also not somebody who ever really thought he was one of the best wrestlers on earth or anything like that. And Marufuji's probably one of my least favorite pro wrestlers of all time. So
I can isolate what the problem was, though. The problem was having Kent and Marufuji wrestle each other.
Well, yeah.
That's
true.
Well, A, because they were baby faces and the dynamic in that sense never really worked well. But stylistically,
they were better as a team.
Stylistically, not only were they better as a team, but, I mean, just match-wise, their styles were not made to go up against each other.
And no, they were absolutely better as a team.
I will say that right now. But, I mean, when you think about everyone they faced, whether it's Kanemaru or Takeiwa, I mean, all of those guys had much better singles matches with each of them than they had with each other.
Yeah.
And they didn't have a strong antithesis to go up against them.
Yeah, and I mean,
in that era.
And as a heavyweight, at least, I feel like Marufuji's best work was in the tag team with Morishima.
Yeah. That's a good point.
I mean, those guys, yeah, that was a really underrated team, I guess because it was never really a full-time team. But he formed that group, but Marufuji formed that Takeshi Rikimaru group with Double Takeshis, or Wild 2, or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
And they had, I'm trying to remember which was the one that I really loved. But I felt like that was probably Morishima's best stuff, and it was also Marufuji's best as a heavyweight.
Yeah. Now, Jun Akiyama, who we talked about, announced he was creating a Noah Hardcore title where he would defend the title against anyone in matches where if it goes to a draw, then a lighter man is declared the winner and new champion. The idea is for him to defend against junior heavyweights mainly, and the first match will take place on April 18th in Fukuoka.
Eh.
So, it didn't last long. It was Akiyama trying to do something different.
Well,
the GAC Openweight Hardcore title.
And there was also a little bit of Pride influence there, because Pride had their various rules that if it was like an open weight match where the heavier guy would, like, where there were different things where, like, the lighter guy could dictate the rules and all sorts of things like that.
Yeah, and then you look at the guys that were the champions, Nakayama Marufuji, Muhammad Yone, Scorpio, Kitaro Shiga, Kishin Kawabata, Makoto Hashi, and Kenta Kobashi. I mean, that was your champion.
Speaking of forgotten wrestlers, Muhammad Yone.
Yeah. So this is something different. Now, Noah had a show on March 13th at Different Ariake where Takeshi Morishima successfully defended his WLW heavyweight title over Juno Zumita. Of course, WLW is World League Wrestling, run by Harley Race. And speaking of Harley Race, Buff Bagwell called into Harley Race's wrestling radio show on March the 9th and complained about how no one has booked him lately. And Race said that he would do his best to get him booked in Noah since he booked some of the foreign talent. Dylan, could you imagine Bob Bagwell working in NOAH in 2004.
To be fair, do we know if he was complaining about not being booked for his gigolo work or as a wrestler?
I don't think he was doing his Scott Casey tribute gimmick yet.
Well, they really love cowboys in Japan, but I don't know if they loved angels.
Can you imagine Buff Bagwell calling up Harley Race's radio or whatever the fuck and complaining that he wasn't getting enough work as a sex worker?
Also, wait a second.
I actually wish...
was Buff Bagwell based out of the suburban, like, Kansas City?
I don't know where he was. I guess he was listening online or something. This is 2004, Big.
I don't know.
I just want to hear Harley Race tell Buff Bagwell he was the drizzling shits. But, oh well. But the Morris Sheeman is Amita. I remember that match. That was a pretty fun match.
Well, Amita was not bad in NOAH.
No, he was good. It was good. And Morishima, of course, this is young Morishima.
Yeah.
So he still can do stuff. And he wasn't as heavy yet.
Mm.
He could still go. But, yeah, that's fun stuff to talk about. This is the era when I was covering all this stuff daily. So this is bringing back lots of memories for me.
This is probably like the peak or just past the peak of us and a lot of other people pretty much watching every promotion.
Yes. This is towards the end. That's for sure. And speaking of other promotions, 01, as World Japan is floundering, Riki Choshu is trying to get a job as booker for Hustle, which of course, 01 and Pride's little group. Choshu has been working fairly regularly with 01 and crowds have gone up lately. Shinjiro Otani has accepted Choshu, but Shin Hashimoto and Naoya Ogawa have not, as a guy wants a singles match with Choshu.
Well, gee, I wonder why Hashimoto is not accepting of Choshu.
Yeah. Now, on March 14th in Sapporo, Shiro Koshinaka and Takao Amore retain their NWA Intercontinental Tag Titles over Rowdy, Koei Sato, and Hirotaka Yokoi. And Wataru Sakata kept his NWA International Junior Heavyweight title over Homicide.
Those two matches both sound awesome.
Yes. And this is names that I haven't, like, Hirotaka Yokoi, that people, I mean, Koei Sato, Rowdy, these guys, I mean, I like 01 a lot. 01 was one of my favorite promotions, but I thought that these two guys were going to be huge names, you know, in years. And of course, it didn't turn out that way. Sato had a pretty good career. Yokoi just fell off the face of the map. But this is, and Sakata, man, what a great worker he was.
Yeah.
Dylan, what are your thoughts about 01?
I always thought 201 was a fun promotion. It's kind of a sad promotion because obviously it's, at least to me, I will always remember it and think of it as the Hashimoto promotion no matter what.
Well, yeah, totally.
And
Dylan?
I mean, even for 01 even existing felt like it wasn't really there anymore. And it's kind of fucked up,
Dylan,
too, because
you dropped
somebody
out
like...
You dropped out for a second. I'm going to assume that you went on a little thing about how once Hashimoto died that the promotion changed.
Yeah. I mean, basically what I was saying is that once Hashimoto died, I feel like it almost lost its justification for being, in a way, because that is sort of what I think most people almost instantaneously associate the promotion with being. So, well, while it was there when Hashimoto was alive, I think it was really, really fun and different and it really felt different and unique from anything else that was going on in Japan, frankly. And it's kind of sad, too, because I think 01 sort of inadvertently became a graveyard for Otani, who has done a lot of good stuff in 01 over the years, but it's stuff that nobody really pays any attention to because, again, after Hashimoto died, no one really cared. So it's like it's a weird little promotion because for this period of time, they had like these fun, unique matchups that seemed completely different and like things that would only happen in 01. You would not see this shit anywhere else. And then it just was sort of over. And to me, it's like a tragic company for me to think about. And sort of, it's very weird to compare it to World Class, but I kind of do compare it to World Class in the sense of how I think of it mentally, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I get that analogy.
But
this was Hideo Ogawa's best work.
Oh my God! Yes.
Yes.
He was fantastic. Year one.
And I guess what I'll say is that you could say the way it was that Noah was probably the best of the promotions at this point in Japan, but 0-1 was probably my favorite and the most fun to watch.
Yes, because 0-1 felt like a promotion that was influenced by things that were happening, like in corners of the earth where there's no it felt like a promotion that was being influenced and shooting an influence back into things that were happening, like in the United States independence. Are even without within the budding freelance culture of like freelance wrestling in Japan, whereas Noah just felt like for lack of a better way of putting it, Noah just felt like All Japan from the mid 90s continued in the best way possible. I guess
occasionally you get someone from New Japan or from 0-1, and but I mean, you talk about the guys here. I mean, Sato was the guy we all thought was going to be the guy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. At the time.
I mean, Yokoi was... what's the best way to describe Yokoi? I guess a guy doing almost kind of like an MMA brawler gimmick?
He was like a Murakami light.
Murakami. That's exactly who I would compare him to.
And Sakata, who had, I think, had... Sakata started in Rings, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
But he was not like a big name or anything there. And then he shows up here as a junior heavyweight and he was really good. And he wasn't just, you would think that a ring style guy would maybe have trouble. That was weird, too, that the rings guys who moved on to the regular pro wrestling promotions both did really well as junior heavyweights. I mean, in terms of adjusting the style, because you had him and you had Naruse in New Japan. And both guys turned out better than you possibly could have expected. And also, I guess the one name I'll drop as far as just weird and being one that no one remembers, Kazuhiko Ogasawara.
Oh, yes.
Who was this karate guy. So it's like watching early FMW or whatever. And he would be in some good matches. I remember where there was one that it was something ridiculous. It was like him and Yokoi against Sakata and... It was someone random that it was just great. And also, as far as the matches that wouldn't happen anywhere else or whatever, Steve Corino worked a program with Ogawa. That happened.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And Steve Corino was a big part of 0-1.
Oh, yeah.
Huge part.
The 0-1 had the great theme song.
Of course. Now, you mentioned Rings. That's a good segue to our next little promotion. You Style. As promotion ran what may have been one of their final shows on March 13th in Osaka, with Kiyoshi Tamura going over Kiyosuke Sasaki by referee stoppage in 16:22. And Bix, I know you love U Style a lot.
U Style was fun. I think it was kind of hampered by just being these occasional one-off shows, I think.
Yeah.
But I think the best thing about U Style was more... Just the guys who would show up, like Frank Shamrock's only pro wrestling matches in New Style.
Yeah.
That type of thing. I never got into it, I think, as much as I thought I would. In a way. But it was definitely a fun promotion to watch. I don't know. I think also, it was kind of... I think we were kind of all wanting something like this at the time, but it wasn't... It did start to feel kind of weird, though, to see guys doing UWF style matches.
Well, Dylan, I think the thing
is versions of shoot style, especially now. My point being is the UWF style. I mean, I guess maybe not, because if you're gonna do shoot style at this point, maybe you should do the version of shoot style that looks the most fake.
Well, my thing is,
well, Dylan, you couldn't do shoots. You couldn't do like ring stuff anymore because ring stuff was more associated with what you saw in Pride and the actual MMA groups. You know, like. Right. I think you had to revert back to the UWF stuff. You ought, whether it was aesthetically what a lot of people would have liked, I think more debatable. But from a logic perspective, I don't really think you had a choice.
Now my question was, Battle Arts had pretty much fallen off the face of the earth by this time period. They were still running shows, but they weren't, you didn't see footage. And I think a lot of us were trying to, you know, New Style was going to take Balor's place. And it just
that
didn't
work
out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was definitely the hope. There's no question about that. Well, I don't think that's a debate at all.
And maybe that's why, for me, I felt like to a degree it was a disappointment because, as we've talked about on the show before, I was always more partial to the wackier battle art stuff. Like your Alexander Otsuka type stuff. Because I was never a fan of Ishikawa versus Ikeda. I was a fan of both guys, but never really against each other. And I liked it better if it was more regular pro wrestling with shoot style pacing as opposed to doing, you know, more of a straight shoot style type of thing, with some exceptions, because I did like the Ishikawa Usuda stuff.
Well, Otsuka's like, you know, I mean, he's basically like if Kurt Angle was actually good.
That's a great analogy.
Like the best way I can describe him, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I love Otsuka. All right, moving on to the Joshi part of the show. As All Japan Women, we had Keio Nomi had her retirement match on March the 10th against Shinobu Kandori, who won with an armbar. And in Neo, we had Momo Nakanishi going over Yoshiko Tamura in 30-29 to win the NWA Pacific Women's title on March the 12th in Kanagawa. Bix, tell everyone, or try to describe to everyone, how popular Momo Nakanishi was to the American Joshi fan base.
Oh, God.
Okay.
Be careful. Don't do anything that can get you sued.
Picture Bailey, only
if Bailey fans were all rape porn addicts.
I didn't even hear what he just said. What did he just say?
Repeat that, Dylan, for Vic.
I said, picture Bailey, but if all of Bailey's fans were rape porn addicts.
Well, I was going to say Bailey, but everyone kind of, A, being more obvious about having a weird sexual fixation on her, but having a weird, I don't want to say sadomasochistic to say bad things about people who participate in loving consensual sadomasochistic relationships, but, like... Where it seemed like there was always this weird line where you could tell they kind of were into her getting beat up.
They were into her selling.
Yeah. I mean, it was... I shouldn't say anything. Cause you
that's why I asked you that. I wanted to make you nervous and squirm on this one. Oh, it was hilarious.
There was someone that wrote a thing that got parodied. By someone else.
Oh, yeah, and yeah, we probably don't need to go into that directly, but I remember when Momo did her Playboy spread, and because it was later on, and a lot of those fans were kind of gone from that time period, but yeah.
Oh, in federal prison?
Yes, Christy Coley. But, man.
Aww.
Yeah. Yeah, Momo Nakanishi, that's a name from the past right there, Dylan. That people, I mean, I can only imagine if Twitter was around back then. Oh. Anyway, I'll move on before we might get even more in legal trouble.
Knowing how her fans are, did they do a reverse Sable with the airbrushing?
I don't know. No, actually, the pictures look pretty good from what I remember. So it didn't look freakish, but I know what you're saying. All right, now we talked about Bob Sapp. K1 ran their Beast show on March 14th at Saitama Super Arena. And we mentioned Blue Wolf earlier, and Bob Sapp faced his brother, Sumiya Bizarre Douglas Sutherland. And they drew a ratings record.
Way better than me at the Mongolian names.
Yes. They drew a ratings record, drawing a 33.2 peak rating, which was 36 million viewers. The show drew a 19.9 rating, and the show was a hybrid of K1 MMA rules. Matches were Ivan Salivari beating Kalawin Bulbatar by decision. Lyoto Machida defeated Michael McDonald, not the Doobie Brothers singer,
or
by submission with a
UFC fighter, I hope.
or the guy from Mad TV. Then Sam Greco beat Stefan Gamlin with a submission in 25 seconds of the first round.
Oh, I forgot. So Stefan Gamlin was a guy they brought in, calling him the White Bob Sapp.
Yes, 25 seconds. That's all he lasted. Alexei Ignashoff defeated...
25 seconds losing by submission to Sam Greco.
Yeah.
Who was a kickboxer.
Yes. Alexei Ignashoff defeated Dr. Death Steve Williams in his first Japanese MMA match by KO after knees in 22 seconds of the first round. And then Sapp beat Douglas Serrin in 5 minutes of the first round after foot injury.
Okay.
This was Bob Sapp, like, at his peak here.
Yes, although I just can't help but think the Dr. Death Steve Williams thing came up when Jordan was on, didn't it?
Yeah, it's sad.
I mean, what it was that he had cancer, but no one knew it yet, so he took this to earn money for medical bills, wasn't it?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
It's sad. It's sad.
And against Alexei what?
And Donk was wrestling for IWA Japan at that time, and I think he was one of the bookers there or something.
Yeah, and he was bringing in all sorts of old Mid-South guys, and it was not the best look for the promotion, because IWA Japan was kind of fun around, like, in the early 2000s, because it was somehow still existing, and then they started doing the different gimmicks, with my favorite being, of course, Asian Cougar becoming Kappa Kozo.
Yeah.
With his, then, remind me, what did Kappa Jr. come from, his little midget? Mini guy.
I can't remember. It's been so
Kappa
long.
Wasn't Kappa Kozu like his spawn that he had with some female wrestler?
Yes.
Kappa Jr.
I can't remember. I mean, it's been so long ago. I wish I would have kept all my old stuff. But yeah, that was a wacky promotion.
Could
but Dylan Bob
no, wait. Could you imagine, as far as like weird pro wrestling storyline pregnancies go, could you imagine Kappa Jr. facing Aki Bono doing his hustle gimmick where he's Jonathan Winters from Mork and Mindy?
Yeah. Where, but the hustle, of course, did all kinds of different stuff.
Yeah, where Great Muda blew mist at erotic terrorist Yin Ling's private area.
Yes.
And then she laid an egg, which contained Aki Bono dressed as a baby.
Yes. Oh, my God. What a wacky era. But Dylan Bob Sapp, he was the biggest star in Japan of anybody.
And it wasn't racist.
It wasn't?
I accidentally muted myself. It wasn't racist at all.
No, it was not racist, was it, Dylan?
No, I mean, he honestly, though, and I say this only half joking, and I'm going to say this kind of shit because it's me. If we're going with the Lesnar precedent, how the hell is Bob Sapp not on the Observer Hall of Fame ballot?
I tell you why. Because he didn't have enough wrestling matches, like wrestling matches, high-profile matches to probably get it. But I get what you're saying, because if you're doing Brock's in on basically his UFC work, Bob Sapp should definitely be in for his K-1 work.
Yes. I mean, like, he was a huge, and not only that, but how many of Bob Sapp's fights were even legitimate? You know what I mean? Like, I think that's an open question, to be honest.
Of course. Yeah.
Like, to say the least, and even beyond just the ones that we know were worked. Like,
Ernesto.
I don't know.
Yeah, Ernesto, who's definitely.
I don't know. I mean, I guess it doesn't really matter at the end of the day, but the point is that Sapp was a huge, 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 huge star. It by far the biggest star in Japan at the time. I don't even think anybody was close.
Absolutely. Now, since we don't have a whole lot of the other international stuff, we're going to group it all together in one section. As we go to the United Kingdom, and National Championship Wrestling ran a show on March 13th in Reading, England, where Shane Douglas defeated Robbie Brookside to win the vacant NCW heavyweight title. Shane Douglas, Robbie Brookside, 2004, Dylan. How did that match went?
That is about as random a match as it gets, actually. I can't even imagine why you would even do that as a match. Like, how? That's weird. That's very weird, to say the least.
those guys don't go together at all. For people who've never seen Robbie Brookside wrestle, or maybe just know his name from like WWE or whatever, like as a trainer, he's not like, how would you describe him? Maybe like an English version of a blowjob. I don't even know how you would describe him. Really.
Like he was the English version of a Memphis style or Southern style babyface.
Yeah. I mean like, yeah, he's just not, he's actually pretty good, but it's just an odd person to be wrestling Shane Douglas of all people.
Maybe a British version of an Armstrong.
Yes, that's a good, like a British version of Scott Armstrong. That's actually a really good comparison.
Yeah.
Real quick before you say something. I think that the deal with Shane Douglas is at this, in the early 2000s, the British promotions had this weird obsession with ex-ECW guys.
Oh, everybody did at this point.
Oh,
yeah, but even Britain more than normal.
You mean like bringing Nova to wrestle Doug Williams?
Yeah, stuff like that. You know, they just had this weird obsession. But what are your thoughts about this, Biggs?
I'm with Dylan that it's just the most random match ever. Like, it's like, you know, I'm just trying to figure out how to describe it, and I'm just in my head, I'm like, this match is purple, and I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just like, I can't even think of words that really fit because it's happening. Like, I don't understand why, so.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Mexico. Paraguayo Senior made his return to Arena Mexico on March 12th, which seems to be building towards him coming out of retirement at the age of 58, and it did. Apollo Dante, Cien Connors, and Universo Dos Mil beat Pero Jr., Black Warrior, and La Park. And they continued to beat down on Perito after the match until Perro made a save, but he was beaten down as well. And this led to the double hair match. Yeah, I think it was a double hair match. In Dos Leyendas, one of the very first Dos Leyendas shows. And, Perro Jr., he is still a technico here, but that turn's coming. But they were doing whatever they could to try to get him over as a technico, but it wasn't working, Bix.
Yeah.
It just wasn't.
When was the, like, match of the year level match with Universo? That was the end of this year, right?
Well, he had been Rudo. He turned Rudo then. So I know. I think it was 05, maybe. Or maybe it was end of 03.
He was a technico when it happened, though.
Yeah, but 03 then.
Okay, so it was 03. Because then, like, to speak to what you're talking about, though, like, he has this amazing match with Universo Dos Mil. And it's, like, booked with Universo to be very strong heel to get sympathy. Like, he's beating up Perito right in front of Perro at ringside. But they did it on a, like, Cien Caras Appreciation Night show. Where Universo's big brother is being honored, so the crowd didn't go with it. So,
yeah. Didn't work out as planned. They tried.
Look that match up online, which I think it was Tim Evans.
Well, there's a few of them.
Put it up. No, but the one I'm talking about.
Yeah, there's a few different Perro Universo matches, but I'll tell you, I mean, that Dylan, the Perro versus Dean Ameda's feud, that went on forever. But you look at some of these names, I mean, L.A. Park, this is L.A. Park was back in Arena Mexico, and that was a huge deal at the time when he came in because he was never there in that gimmick. He had, you know, worked for, you know, the promotion as Principe Island and then, you know, became La Parca in AAA. And now he has been here for a while. And that was a huge dip in his career to get in this promotion.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess the other big takeaway, and I'll be the first person to say I'm not a huge lucha expert from this period, but is that this is like right before CMLL started to get like really hot. Like, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like about maybe what, 6-7 months before?
Yeah, well, it started in the summer. It was probably, okay. I would say June and July is when everything really started.
Okay, so but the point is you're getting, like, it's right before things sort of kicked, and before you knew it, like, CMLL was like a top promotion. So it's just kind of interesting to see what was going on with some of the players right before the promotion, like, took off and became arguably, well, no, not even arguably, definitely the hottest promotion in the world for a while.
Oh, totally. Well, on that note, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to get back to America. And, boy, there's a lot of stuff going on. Ring of Honor, TNA. But we're going to come back. We're going to do a little potpourri to start off with. And we got Hawaii Wrestling and Joni Lauer. We'll come back after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation, placetobenation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner, at least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and placetobenation.com. You can check out Scott Criscullo and me on the Mothership, The Place to Be Podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Main Event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. And relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series, led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We got sports covered too with the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy, and Cowboy Sr., the Kings of Sport led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast and the TJ McClune Show. PTBN tackles pop culture and irreverence with Richard and the Mailman, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, and if you like a hybrid of all of this in list form, check out Jordan Duncan's Rank and File. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. We want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network. That's the PWO PTBN Podcast Network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the reaction shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Team's Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
And we're back. And listen to those great shows you just heard advertised during that commercial break that all of us are on. And don't forget, for this show in particular, whenever you shop on Amazon.com, use our referral link, tinyurl.com/BTSAmazon. And, of course, we get a little piece of the pie, and you pay nothing extra. It just comes off of your purchases off Amazon. And God knows I've been burning it to death lately with all the Amazon orders I do. So join the fun, as we say. And speaking of fun, let's go to potpourri. And I remember this when I typed this up, I remember thinking this, you know, doing this at the time in real time when it's going on, thinking, this is just insane. But Hawaii Championship Wrestling on March 13th, yeah, there was a promotion in Hawaii that was, you know, doing okay at this time period. They brought in Yoji Anjo, Jamal, of course, Umaga, Tai Okea, Koichi Kimura, and Kunsuke Sasaki from Japan, and Jamal and Kea, who was there's a mystery partner, non-advertised, got a huge pop. They won the HCW tag titles from Kenjiro Katahira and Kenshin. And Bix, yeah, this is the promotion where Mr. Wrestling 3 was born, too, as Steve Corino took the gimmick on and was endorsed by Mr. Wrestling 2 because Johnny Walker lives in Hawaii. And, of course, Mr. Wrestling 3 is, you know, prominent these days on Ring of Honor television. But this little Hawaii Championship Wrestling group, they Chono was there sometimes. I mean, they were a pretty interesting group.
This was Don Morocco's promotion, right?
Yes.
Yeah, weird mix of Japanese guys and just other dudes. And, wait, Koichiro Kimura is Super Uchi Power, right?
Yes.
What a weird mix of guys. Was he even working in Japan when this was going on? Like,
yeah,
as himself or Super Uchi?
He was working as himself, and I think he was working with All Japan.
Okay,
because he had worked DDT and, you know, other groups, but he was in All Japan at this time period as Andrew's partner and stuff like that.
Okay, I have no memory of that at all. All I know is I have Super Uchu power.
Yeah. Now Dylan, Taiokea, of course, a native, he's a guy that never gets talked about today. Never. I mean, what do you talk about Taiokea?
Well, I mean, there was a period where he was one of the guys, like, you know, one of the guys in Japan, you know? And not that, I mean, it wasn't like it was that small of a time frame. I mean, there was a few years at least that memory serves, where he was, you know, to the extent that there were stars with any star power in Japan during that era, he was one of them.
He was Muto's number two and Bat.
Yep.
And that's when he got big.
And just, it's kind of weird because he isn't any, I mean, nobody ever talks about him anymore, ever.
No, I always enjoyed him. I thought he was really good in some spots. One of the better guys in All Japan in that era. So, yeah, it's a guy who just never gets talked about. Well, speaking of something that doesn't get talked about, Joni Lauer's first concert with the China Dolls took place on March the 12th at El Rey Theater in Los Angeles in front of 40 fans in a 1,000-seat building. Now, Dylan, you have done your fair share of concerts in the past. 40 fans in a 1,000-seat building, that's pretty goddamn terrible.
Yeah, that's pretty fucking bad, considering the fact that when I was playing music and doing promotion, which I did for years and years and years, if you did any sort of promotion at all, you could get a couple hundred people for any kind of band with any sort of notoriety, but I guess China's music career was not meant to be. I mean, I can't even, that's a very weird story just in general. Like, it's just weird that, like, of all the weird things that she's done, I think most of them you think of and you're like, yeah, that guy can totally see her doing that. But, like, her playing in a band for some reason, I think, is, like, just transparently absurd. Like, I can't imagine, like, even the idea of it to me just seems absurd. I don't know.
And this, Biggs, this was, like, would you say the beginning of the China train wreck era?
Hmm. Because I'm trying to remember. So she's done with New Japan at this point, right?
Totally. Yeah.
I mean, because she sort of had those issues. I mean, she always, you know, she had the book, so it's not like there wasn't always something there. But this is the beginning of China as we know her now.
Because wasn't she, like, promoting the China Dolls on that the Stern show?
Oh, the one where she stripped naked all of a sudden and said she had been in Japan wrestling lions and tigers? Yes.
Yes. Okay. There you go. So we're in that time period. Yeah.
And remember, I remember it's like she shows up and, like, they're like, "Are you okay?" And she's like, "Yeah, I've been in Japan wrestling lions and tigers." And they're like, "Seriously, are you okay?"
She didn't wrestle Tiger Mask 4, if I remember right.
It's possible, to be honest. Like, that guy's wrestled everyone.
She wrestled Tiger Mask 4. If she wrestled, she would have wrestled Tiger Mask 4 on a logo that has a lion. Well, actually, did they have a
there
logo?
You go.
Did they have the logo on the mat back then? I don't know. But close enough.
Yeah. That's what she was thinking about. But what a mess. And, yeah, that's nothing to be said about that. There was a big article in USA Today on March the 12th about the deaths of wrestlers under the age of 45 in recent years. The article pointed out that there have been 65 premature deaths out of an estimated 1,000 active wrestlers since 1997, which was well above the rate of any major sports. And Biggs, this is also the era where, yes, we have quite a few deaths of wrestlers at young ages.
Yeah, I mean, this article was a big deal. If I remember correctly, came up years later because of what was it that Jerry McDevitt said in it about drug testing?
I can't remember.
It was that everyone beats it or something like it was.
I can't remember.
But there was something, right?
Yes.
Dylan?
And this article was like part of it.
Do you remember?
I don't fucking remember.
McDevitt said so much stuff.
My buddy.
Yeah. But yeah, this
your dear close personal longtime friend, I think.
Yeah. And Dylan, steroids is the one of the main factors in this.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think the thing that stands out the most is the fact that this was like when the Benoit murders would happen a couple years after this, I guess it was 3 years after this, the mentality for a lot of people was, oh, well, this is like for people in the mainstream was this is a news, like they were treated like it was a news story. And then like all this stuff, like they sort of trotted out a lot of these same statistics, which of course had gotten worse by then. And the mentality is like, oh my God, I can't believe this is going on. But this just goes to show you that this was something that was reported on in the mainstream media even before the Benoit killings. So it's not like, I think it is a little bit telling about the way media culture works too, because you know, you would think if you had watched the Benoit, you know, media coverage in real time when it happened in 2007, depending on what you were watching, you might be convinced that this had never been a national news story before. And that's complete bullshit. You know, like, I mean, just here we are 3 years before the Benoit killings, 3.5 years, really. And it's, you know, a USA Today story.
Absolutely. That narrative definitely is not true about the, you know, becoming a big deal. I mean, there were other places that were covering this stuff too. So, yeah, it didn't start with Benoit. And speaking of major news stories involving wrestling, now the week before is when the major stuff went down. So now we're dealing with the aftermath. That's when Ring of Honor, and on March the 9th, it was announced that Doug Gentry, also known as Ring of Honor announcer Ray Morrow, was named the CEO and president of RF Video / Ring of Honor after purchasing all of Rob Feinstein's stock in the companies. But of course, there were no records of such a transaction, and this was just corporate speak for them kicking Feinstein out of his company. RF Video Inc. was basically Feinstein, Gabe Sapolsky, and Gentry in charge, with other employees working in office dubbing tapes, conducting interviews, and planning Ring of Honor events, with Feinstein being the 100% owner of the video part and 51% of the Ring of Honor part. There is said to have been a silent partner who has helped fund the growth of Ring of Honor, who came aboard when the new lighting system came into place, but his identity has never been revealed. The company also hired a crisis management team right after the Feinstein story broke last week. Now, when the word got out about Feinstein, ticket sales rose noticeably for the March 13th show in Elizabeth, New Jersey, because it was being expected that the wrestlers would be fired up to put on a great show, knowing that a bad show at this time couldn't come at a worse time. Nobody knows, though, how the fans will react, because there's a mob mentality at times on these shows, which could be positive or negative depending on how the show goes. Wrestling past, though, has proven when owners and promotions have been in trouble, the fans are more often than not have stayed loyal because of the fantasy of wrestling and all entertainment is 1,000 times stronger than reality. Now, this is all Dave speaking. They will not support a product, though, that doesn't entertain them, which is what happened with WWF in the mid-90s, because the scandals didn't hurt business. The lack of entertainment did. Now, virtually all the talent that worked for Ring of Honor on a regular basis pledged its allegiance to the company, but Bobby Heenan, who was supposed to work shows in April in the Chicago-Minneapolis area for $1,000 a shot, pulled out after the news broke on advice from his confidants because he has a book coming out and he doesn't want the controversy to be a cloud hanging over the promotional tour. This put the kibosh on Sapolsky's biggest promotion idea of the year, which was a matchup of Heenan and Jim Cornette as dueling managers doing dueling promos, which would be the first time that ever happened. Cornette said that he was still going to work for Ring of Honor, but Low Key, who had no future booking, said that he wouldn't work for them again, and Abyss put out a few days later. It is also believed Roddy Piper, who was booked for an appearance on March 13th, also won't be coming in, as he isn't returning any phone calls from Ring of Honor. The company was most afraid of AJ Styles leaving over this, since at first he was on the fence, because he may be the company's most popular wrestler, and unlike much of the regulars, has a high-profile job in TNA. He's also well known for being a devout Christian. And he said that, quote, "I am aware that some priests and preachers have been accused of similar activity, but that does not mean I will not go to church. Church is not about the preacher, but the people." Another question, though, is regarding doing business in the towns, as Feinstein was instrumental in getting the promotion in the new markets, with more coming throughout 2004, including running Northern California. But Dave wonders how other promoters will now use the Feinstein scandal to hurt their chances of getting to these markets. Sapolsky said regarding the future of Ring of Honor that they were just going to try. That's all. Now, Bix, I want you to give a concise version of the Rob Feinstein scandal for people that don't really know what happened.
Where do I start? Okay. It was far from a secret, although I guess to him it was, that Rob Feinstein is gay. Although, I mean, he knew people knew, he just denied it. And then, so I guess the week before this, the NBC affiliate in Philly does a story with pervertedjustice.com, pre To Catch a Predator. And one of the people who arrived at the house and who they showed they had chat logs of was Rob Feinstein. And, of course, the most damaging portion of the transcript that they posted was where the alleged gay teenager says he's 14, and Feinstein allegedly replies with, "Damn, spelled D-A-M-M, 14, LOL, I'll pretend you said 18. And then there was all sorts of other stuff. I mean, it was, the writing style was certainly authentic to Feinstein, and this led to him kind of being forced out of the company. At first, he was still technically there while everyone else was, except for Doug, was trying to figure out how to force him out. And then
we should also note that this was before Perverted Justice was like always working with the police, so I don't believe he was actually arrested.
Yeah, the police were not involved with this, correct?
He was never arrested.
They had done some with the police before then, but not this one.
No.
So he wasn't gone from ROH until a few months. He was always with RF Video, but he wasn't gone until ROH officially until a few months later, where they kind of forced upon him that Carrie Silkin, who was the mystery investor mentioned, had to buy him out. And that was, I mean, I guess that's that as far as immediately. As far as the whole situation, what would be the best way to summarize Rob's defense of what happened? Okay, should I just go with the things that actually are good points in his favor, I guess? To be fair,
go ahead.
There are no screenshots or anything of the chat log. It's all whatever they pasted into the website. When they talk about talking about the phone, it's not even a transcript. It's just an account of what they said he said, including, "To prove you're not a cop, put on MTV. Police stations don't have MTV." Yeah. So now Bob Barnett, who, you know, had his whole thing with Feinstein, you know, wrote an article at, where was it, Pro Wrestling Between the Sheets?
Yeah.
Where he talked about the things, you know, leading up to that. We kind of heard about the idea that Rob was into perhaps young teenage guys. And one of the things he mentioned, which was something he had hinted at before, although then people thought it was just that he was kind of making fun at Rob for being so closeted, which he was at the time, was that he was being constantly seen at a gay bar in Philly, I guess the big gay bar in Philly, Woody's, on a certain night. Bob then explained that it was that he was there on whatever their teen night was. So when I wrote something about this in Figure Four on the anniversary of everything, wait, was it the anniversary or was it, no, not the anniversary, it was or maybe it was. It was whenever Feinstein wrote that thing on Facebook. So maybe that was last year. I don't remember. I wrote something, and people started pointing out that Woody's had a college night where half the bar was adult college students who were under 21 and half was the regular drinking crowd.
So when you factor that in, that it ties into apparently something that Bob had been alleging, and that maybe some of it was not entirely true, and then also that the guy behind Perverted Justice was someone who had been known in wrestling circles, Xavier Von Erk, who was known more as a pro-Russo guy than anything, if I remember correctly. You can sort of see why, regardless of what actually happened, you can see why he thinks he was set up. He always says that nothing was said about the age, that there was a profile on AOL, because this was all on AOL, where the guy, where there was a profile for the other person, and it said that, and I know it had a photo, and it, or it hadn't maybe even had an age, and it was some college-age-looking guy. Dylan, you might remember, who was it that actually backed him up on that said he showed them the profile before it got deleted?
Oh, I don't remember, but I do remember that it was somebody who seemed reputable.
Was it Mike Johnson?
It could have been Mike Johnson, but I don't want to say that because I don't know for sure.
You don't want him to threaten to beat both of us up?
Well, I don't care if he threatens to beat me up.
Well, sure.
he's welcome to try.
But no, I remember it being someone like a Mike Johnson.
It could have been. I don't remember. I don't want to put that on Mike. I can be hard
no,
on Mike.
No, I don't want to either. If I'm wrong, I don't want to. So, but I really don't remember who it was. Other stuff happened. There was the thing where someone wrote a letter to the Observer site defending him. I won't say who. I mean, people thought it was someone like Tommy Dreamer or Raven. From what I've heard, it was not. And I guess that's about it. I mean, you know, Feinstein had a no-compete deal with ROH for a certain amount of time. Then he got back into promoting. He didn't really stick with the promoting much. And then when some of it expired, you know, ROH doing shoot interviews didn't last too long either. And I mean, that was it. I mean, is there much else to say?
Not really. But Dylan, I know you got some thoughts on this, especially the AJ Styles statement.
Well, okay, a couple things.
By the way, I apologize if that was not succinct enough, because...
No, it's fine. A couple things, I think, about this. Number one, how scummy are fucking wrestling fans that ticket prices, ticket sales go up when one of the promoters gets caught being a potential child molester? It's like... Nothing's a bigger draw with internet obsessed pro wrestling fans in the early 2000s than realizing that somebody's like them. It's kind of like when I went to Survivor Series this year and I realized that like 90% of Kevin Owens fans look exactly like him. But I need to stop because I know I'm part of online fan culture, so I'm taking shots at people that I'm.
You care.
Yes, and I'm half kidding, to be fair. But I would say though, like this whole thing is like really kind of in a weird way. It's hilarious. Like I don't want to make light of it because it's really not funny. But in a weird way, it's hilarious because this promotion that sort of had made their bread and butter on like the rise of digital culture and the internet and all this stuff almost completely collapses because of basically an internet sting operation. Like, I think if you think about that, that's like, I mean, because Ring of Honor is obviously still open, still in business, and arguably doing better than they ever have been, at least in some respects, but. At the time, there was real doubt as to whether or not Ring of Honor would even survive. I mean, that was a real concern.
Oh,
people
yeah.
really thought this might be it for them. And frankly, there was every reason to think it was a possibility that would be it for them because
especially because no one thought Feinstein was really gone, which he wasn't.
No one believed Rob was really gone. Well, a lot of people thought that they didn't have the money without Rob. I mean, I remember that being a talking point that I heard.
Huge talking point.
Like without Rob's the money guy and without Rob, how could they go on even if they wanted to? Which is one of the reasons I think more than anything why people theorized that Rob wasn't really gone. Because the theory was, well, he's the money guy. How the fuck could he be gone?
So that's like one facet that I think is kind of worth thinking about, is the fact that at the time, a lot of people thought this was legitimately the end of Ring of Honor, or could be the end of Ring of Honor. I think the other amusing thing, of course, is AJ Styles effectively comparing Ring of Honor to a church and Rob Feinstein to a priest is one of the most inadvertently hilarious things ever.
Oh, man.
And I'm very disappointed. I'm very disappointed that AJ didn't comment on the gay community.
I was going to say, this must have confirmed his most negative feelings about the gay community.
Oh, totally. Well, they went ahead and had their show, At Our Best, which is a great title for the show.
And they did, by the way. This was the biggest crowd in ROH history, by far.
Yeah, they drew 1,800 fans at the Rexplex in Elizabeth, New Jersey. 700 tickets were sold in advance by March 3rd, which is the day before the Feinstein scandal broke. So they sold 1,100 tickets afterwards.
And
they're also threatened.
Well, and again, this is the first ever WrestleMania weekend indie show of note.
Yeah. And they're also threatened.
Although it should be... It should be noted that the Rexplex is a ways away from downtown New York, or Manhattan.
Well,
although there have been,
I mean, there were indie shows in, there were indie shows 3 years ago that ran away, that ran a lot further away from Manhattan than Elizabeth did well.
PWS was much farther, for example. So, yes, that's true. But.
I don't know about the correlation between that, though. I mean, between this and WrestleMania. I just think there was a lot of people that went from the area. Now, there were threats of protests from church groups that never came to be, and the building was threatened to cancel because they housed children's parties.
Yeah, should I explain what the Rexplex is, I guess?
Yeah, go ahead.
It is like one of those places that has like a roller hockey rink and basketball courts and an arcade. And
It's also... It's also worth noting that the Rexplex is the site of a famous punk rock slash hardcore music festival that happened right around the same time period, Hellfest, where the Bad Luck 13 Riot Extravaganza like threw meat carcasses and like maced people in the crowd and destroyed the bleachers and everything and like completely wrecked the whole fucking building. This is kind of a place that is sort of had around this same time period. Put on events that were pretty not family friendly, to say the least. Yeah. So, yeah.
I mean, what else? They also had. I'm trying to remember. They also had boxing matches from there, and I think maybe some MMA.
Yep.
I mean, there were very somewhat notable boxing venue, weren't they? Because weren't the fights from Rexplex on what was it like Telefutura or something?
That may be actually.
Sounds about right. Now, Dusty Rhodes replaced Roddy Piper and did an angle of Ox Baker as they were selling their gimmicks. We had the show opened up with a six-man mayhem. Amazing Red defeated Teddy Hart, Sanjay Dutt, Jimmy Rave, Jack Evans, and Mark Briscoe. Now, Sapolsky felt pressure to start the show off strong, so the first person out of the curtain was the returning Red. Hart had Sabu to be his bodyguard backstage, and he didn't come out in front of the fans. It wasn't so much everyone's afraid of Sabu, but he was so respected that no one would mess with him. They did a fake shoot spot after the match where Evans started doing backflips and breakdancing, which prompted the other guys to attack Evans and Hart. What annoyed people was management was running to the ring saying, quote, "He's shooting," unquote, which is the biggest tip-off that he isn't. Yeah, this is the era of Teddy Hart as being the most controversial man in wrestling. Now, Xavier defeated Slick Wagner Brown. He had no one contender match for the pure wrestling title. Jerry Lynn over Nigel McGuinness. Yeah, the no-one contender match for the Ring of Honor World Heavyweight title. Matt Stryker with Y and Unibrow over John Walters. You had Danny Moff and BJ Whitmer going to a no contest with Colt Cabana and Ace Steel. Ring of Honor pure wrestling title match. AJ Styles defeated CM Punk to retain. Ricky Steamboat as a guest referee, who got the biggest pop of company history, supposedly. Joe came out and confronted Styles with Steamer getting in the middle, but he shook his hand. Punk then assaulted Steamboat, calling him an old man and a crappy referee before jumping him. Steamboat then made a comeback using his chops and trademark deep arm drag. Steel cage match for the Ring of Honor World Heavyweight title. Samoa Joe defeated Jay Briscoe to retain in a bloodbath. Styles used a Styles clash on Mark Briscoe to keep him from interfering. In your main event, Scramble Cage 2, the Carnage Crew, HC Lope, Tony DeVito, Justin Credible, Masada defeated Special K, with Logan DeVito giving Angel Dust a stuffed pile driver off the top of the cage through two tables, and DeVito saying that he wished he had killed him. All right, Dylan, thoughts about this show?
It takes a lot of balls to put Special K on in your main event after Feinstein's fire. Allegedly, I don't know that Rob ever did anything. In fact, it's possible that he did.
Well, you should probably explain the whole Special K RF joke thing to people.
Why?
Because there are people who aren't around for Special K that need to understand why people thought that there were improprieties, or at least like to joke that there were.
Okay, well, do I have to explain what a twink is?
No.
Google twink.
I would just say that the Special K gimmick, the Special K gimmick was like a hybrid between, not really your club, I guess kind of your club scene kids with,
yes.
With your, but with particularly twinkish body type overtones. Whether that was deliberate or not is debatable. I mean, it may have just been the guys that were involved. I mean, that's just the way it goes, right? But there were jokes at the time that Special
they're rave guys. They were ravers.
Yeah, and I mean, there were jokes at the time that Special K was a gimmick that sort of may have appealed to the current interests of certain people. I'll just put it that way.
And Special K, of course, was a word for drug.
Yes.
Ketamine.
I will say also, though, that I recently watched the Joe versus Jay Briscoe match. I hadn't watched it in probably 4 or 5 years, maybe longer. And I just watched it maybe 3 or 4 months ago. And that match holds up pretty well. I mean, as a, brutal, crazed bloodbath, in a unique setting with a, smallish, underdogish guy versus Joe, it really does hold up pretty well. I mean, I don't think it would rate, if I'm being honest, with anything close to the best Ring of Honor matches, but it's a really unique match, I feel like, for that promotion during the time period. And if you are used to the Jay Briscoe of today, that was absolutely not the Jay Briscoe of then.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because you said smallish, underdogish guy.
Basically how he is. No, no. Not at all.
Is it as disgustingly bloody as I really remember?
Like, oh yeah, it's a complete bloodbath.
But wasn't the blood visibly coagulating?
Oh yeah, it's like congealing on his head. Sure.
Yeah.
Who doesn't want to see that?
And of course, the Steamboat deal was huge at the time period.
Oh yeah, yeah, that was a huge deal, no question.
All right, Bix, any thoughts on the show? Okay. There was an afternoon show held earlier in the building drawing 600 fans. So they had two shows now. They're $5 ahead, where Austin Aries and Roderick Strong made the strongest impressions on Sapolsky and will get used in higher profile spots in the future.
And that happens quickly.
Very quickly.
Yeah, really quickly.
Yeah, very quickly. Now, let's move on to TNA. TNA President Dixie Carter announced a new marketing campaign on March the 10th at the CTAM conference in Los Angeles called Wrestling Reinvented. Dixie said that the contest of wrestling has gotten out of hand. In an effort to shock the viewer, storylines in our industry that were once considered obscene are now unfortunately commonplace. For a period of time now, TNA has made a conscious shift in the content of our shows and will continue to do so. We have distinguished our product from our competitor and provided the pay-per-view buyer with a true alternative. Wrestling Reinvented is moving forward to the past, and our programming will be clean, but also innovative, cutting edge with the high risk, high flying athleticism that TNA is known for, unquote. Now, part of this change is to make the TV deal with Fox Sports Network, which is insisting on a clean product. At this point, there is no deal, but they're talking about a tryout like FSN gave USC that didn't even lead to a deal, even though ratings were strong, partially because sponsors sponsorship shied away. The shows will be taped on Thursdays in Orlando. If the deal comes through, they will likely have a regular 40-man roster. There's been a lot of talk late about the ownership with the people that had backed the Randy Savage rap album showing interest in the company. Thus far, nothing has happened here either, but there is hope that Panda will either step to the plate, which Dave guessed it means they will spend more money to upgrade a product and do television, or get rid of the product and let someone else take it over. All right, Bix. How about Dixie Carter's marketing campaign? Wasn't that a crock of shit, considering that Vince Russo was working there?
Was Sports Entertainment Extreme still a thing at this point?
No.
Well, that's something.
Was this but was this the period where Vince Russo was pretending he was a Christian yet or not?
No, that would be later.
When was that?
Okay.
That would be, I'd say, about 3 years later, maybe. 2 or 3 years later.
Is that late? I thought it was closer to this. Okay.
May have been. Some of this time period is a blur, but yeah, he wasn't as technically a booker. It was Jarrett and Dutch were the bookers, but if you watch the shows, you can see where Russo's hands were on it.
You mean kind of like how he wasn't really a booker when he wasn't really working for them, except he was because Dixie Carter emailed Mike, or because he accidentally emailed Mike Johnson or whoever. I can't
funny
even
how that works.
DNA email scandals.
I know. It's funny how that works. So, yeah, what do you think, Bix, about all this spiel?
Well, what's the CTAM conference in the first place?
CTAM is, they just have one. Let's see here.
It's the Bobo version of, what do you call it?
It's a cable deal.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the Bobo version of the real cable conference.
Yeah, kind of. CTAM is all about strengthening cable's business by driving results through a mix of cooperative marketing, strategic collaboration, and executive education. On behalf of more than 80 corporate members, CTAM leads various marketing initiatives such as Cable Mover, TV Everywhere, and delivers highly rated executive education programs to promote new thinking and marketing information.
So was the idea that
CTAM is Cable and Telecommunications Association for Marketing.
So was the idea that she was speaking there because she was a person with a background in PR who was doing this, quote, new innovative concept of weekly pay-per-views?
Yes.
As opposed to even though there was no actual success?
Yes.
Fantastic.
The more things change, the more they stay the same. TNA, again, Dixie Carter. Boy, this is 2004, people. 2004. And you see the stupidity just dripping off of the people in charge. Dylan, and of course, they eventually got that Fox Sports deal, Dylan, but we know how well that turned out.
Well, I mean, I guess at the time it was kind of like, seemed pretty impressive and kind of like a big deal. I mean, relative to what they were doing prior to that. But yeah, I mean, TNA, from a business perspective, TNA has pretty much always been a disaster. I think if you're really being objective about it, it's kind of like TNA was, we joke about WCW always being like kind of a clusterfuck creatively from the beginning, as soon as Turner took over, but that's actually true, even though I think a lot of people don't realize it, but they did at least have a couple years of profitability. Like, TNA has pretty much been a disaster from day one with none of the positives. So I think that tells you all you really need to know about TNA.
And thing about, thing is, WCW only lasted 12 years.
Yeah.
TNA has lasted, it'd be 14 years in June. That's crazy. Yeah. Think about it. Crazy, just absolute crazy. But anyway, they had a show that was on March the 10th. This was still weekly pay-per-views. So this was taped. They did two a week. So this was taped on March the 3rd. And this featured the America's X Cup 2 with Team Canada versus Team AAA. And boy, what a show this was. Teddy Hart beat Mr. Aguila at 9-12 with a heart attack too, but he injured, quote-unquote, his left knee during the match and might not be able to go later. Juventud Guerrero defeated Petey Williams in 9 minutes with the Hoobie Driver. Johnny Devine beat Abismo Negro in 6 minutes with a Rewind Rana. So, and then we have a little vignette where they cut backstage to Glenn Gilberti, Disco Inferno, acting as Davey Young's psychiatrist. And the former Disco Inferno asked Dave a series of questions. Question one, growing up, did you watch Bozo the Clown? David Young said, I'm from East Tennessee, Glenn. Growing up, we only had three channels. Bozo wasn't on. Question two, did you like going to the circus? David Young said, of course, I didn't like going to the circus. Who would? Question number three, when you watch professional wrestling, did you like or dislike Doink the Clown? David said, don't be dumb, Glenn. I hated him. That's the most ridiculous. And Ken Cash entered the scene. Ask what's going on here. Glenn's trying to psychoanalyze David to see why he's scared of clowns. And Kid said what he needs to do is get ready for his match against Insane Clown Posse and the Juggalos. We're outnumbered 1,000 to 2, Glenn said. He'll get ready as soon as he's done. But Kid flips out and says they need to get ready now. Glenn agrees and tells David that he and Cash will take care of ICP, and all he needs to do is take care of Too Tough Tony. Wow. Hector Garza defeated Jack Evans in 6:37 with the Tornillo. And now we get to the tag match part of this thing. Abismo Negro and Juventud Guerrero beat the New Generation Heart Foundation, Jack Evans and Teddy Hart in 7:19, when Hoobie used a stretch muffler on Hart's bad knee. Then we go to Scott Hudson, my dear friend, who's in the back with ICP, Too Tough Tony, and Rude Boy, all of which are wearing these psychopathic jerseys with a Hatchet Man camouflage. Jason, the Juggalos are lined up in Nashville, but can't get in because they're lined up all the way to Memphis. They're here to see the Superfly Spectacular Shaggy Two Twist and Violent Vehicular Homicide Jay doing what they do best with Too Tough Tony. And close out by saying, now let us continue our herbal exercises out in the limo. Because goddamn, you got to have that weed reference in 2004 wrestling. Johnny Devine and Petey Williams defeated Mr. Aguila and Hector Garza in 8:52 when Petey pinned Aguila. And then we had the elimination match. Team AAA, all the guys we mentioned from Mexico earlier, beat Team Canada, all the guys mentioned earlier, in 14:44 when Garza used a tornillo on Williams. Here's the story behind this match, though. Hoobie was upset that he wasn't the last man standing tall, and he complained that he was the biggest star on his team, so he should be there in the end. He asked who came up with the idea, and he was told by Scott D'Amore that it was Jeff Jarrett. So Hoobie shut up, but the damage was done, though, because he did this in front of his teammates with all of them knowing English and understood what he was saying. The idea was to beat Hoobie as a surprise and reward Garza for working hard, but Hoobie thought that once he was eliminated, the fans would quit caring about the match. Then once the match came, referee Mike Posey, our beloved P-Dog, got the cue to speed things up, and they went too fast as they did 7 eliminations in about 3 minutes. The working idea is for Team AAA to defend against Team Japan next. That's not even the main event. As your Dark Carnival match feature Glenn Gilberti, Kid Cash, and David Young versus Shaggy, Too Dope, Violent J, Rude Boy, and Too Tough Tony in 12 minutes when Cash used a frog splash off a ladder on Tony after help from Monty Brown. ICP and their crew are no longer with TNA. And regarding the Juventud Guerrero deal, Meltzer said the TNA looks bad when Hoobie is, who is better than anyone on their roster, including AJ Styles, and he gets up with no push while they shove their own guys so hard down your throat, and you hear crickets chirp when they're out there. Dylan, what a show this is. Thoughts about I'm going to ask you first about David Young. Thoughts about the David Young stuff, about East Tennessee and all that good stuff, because you're a good old East Tennessee boy.
Well, first of all, I really like David Young. I think he was actually an underrated wrestler. I saw him live several times over the years, right around this time period. My brothers used to see him live a lot because he worked the Chattanooga indie scene really regularly during this time period. You know, to me, David Young is an example. It's kind of funny, like the sort of line and the argument about Hoovie and these other guys being more talented, like not that it's necessarily referring to David Young, but because I think there's a lot of those guys that were working TNA during this time period, like the East Tennessee, Georgia guys that worked there a lot from the period, you know, from when they opened basically to about maybe late 2004-ish, I guess. I think a lot of those guys were actually really good, you know, but they just never got, they never got the breaks that you need to be next level, I guess. You know what I mean? Like, but yeah, that's that segment with Disco sounds quite awful. And actually, the whole show sounds quite awful, to be honest. I've gone back and actually watched a fair amount of early TNA, as you know, to mainly watch guys like Styles and Amazing Red for the Greatest Wrestler Ever project over at ProWrestlingOnly.com. And a lot of the matches in isolation are actually better than you think. But if you try to, like, they all include all the overbooking staples that piss you off. And pretty much everything outside of the matches is unwatchably bad. Like, it's, like, scary how bad some of it is, even in hindsight. So, yeah, that's TNA for you. I guess some things don't change.
Now, Biggs, Teddy Hart, like I said, was probably the most controversial guy in wrestling at this time period. He had just gotten into a fight with CM Punk, you know, not too long before this in the TNA locker room. That's one of the main reasons why Sabu was his bodyguard in Ring of Honor. I mean, God knows, you know, we talked about Teddy Hart on the Exile on Bad Street I did with Rob Naylor and Wes Hatch. And people just don't understand for a short time period how big of an internet star Teddy was.
Now, wait a second. Wasn't the fight with Punk actually the week that the show was taped?
I think it was either that week or the tapings before.
Because had they brought in the – did they bring in all Teddy for the taping before the X? If that's what it was, then was that. Yeah.
It was in this time period, for sure.
Yeah. And I'm trying to figure out, is there like a comparable figure to 2003, 2004 Teddy Hart?
It was February 25th. Biggs.
Okay.
February 25th.
So it was the week before this was taped. Okay. But is there like someone we can compare him to get the like the feel of what it was like then?
That's
No, I get it. Okay, so think of the Young Bucks.
Nick Gage.
If the Young Bucks and Nick Gage had a psychotic drug addicted baby, I'm not saying that Teddy Hart was drug addicted or even psychotic, but that's how he came off. With that, does that make sense?
Yeah, I get you there.
I could see that.
Because he got the because he was kind of a troll, but kind of not on purpose. And
Death Valley Driver was a huge part of Teddy Hart getting over. In fact, when he posted over there thanking people, I mean, that was one of the pinnacles of that message board.
Didn't everyone think it wasn't really him, too?
Yeah, it was really was him.
I'm trying to remember and how those he got determined, though.
Naylor found out that it was really him.
Well, then he PM'd Naylor and was like,
"Yeah, well, that's all on the
fans. It really gets it, and yeah."
Yeah, invited to Disney World. I mean, that's on the Exile show, which everybody can listen to. That you need to listen to that show from last August.
Well, was it both of them?
Both of them, yeah. Because it was Jersey Kid and Wes that was the real the huge defenders of Teddy, and Naylor was around then too. It was just craziness.
But it was and people were really Jersey kind of Kid who were the ones who would always talk about the Maybach.
Yeah, yeah, the Maybach, yeah.
Did he actually have one, or was that just something they made up?
I think that's something they made up. But, yeah, the Teddy Hart aura was so amazing for about 6 months to a year until he became his own worst enemy. But
and then, the,
God,
of course, the Rob Naylor Teddy Hart mixtape.
Yeah. But another thing that just spawned from this show was the Juventud Guerrera comments, because it was, I think, a week after this that Juventud and Abismo Negro got into the big fight at the locker room in AAA. And
I remember that. What was that about?
Yeah. Well, I think it was
cocaine.
I'm pretty sure there was drugs involved, knowing those two, and you know. Sadly, Abismo Negro is dead. But, yeah, I mean, it was not that long after this that they had the fight. And it was, oh, man, I'm trying to think of, because there was multiple deals here. Now, do you remember they got, Juventud had that one deal later on with the, in 2009 with the shit in the bag and all that stuff. So that wasn't this one where Conan supposedly shit in his bag and he got pissed off about that. But, oh, shit, I can't remember. what, but it spawned from this, because like I said, a week after it happened, and that was when Abismo Negro, I think he left. He left AAA for that time period. Yeah. As I'm vamping here, trying to figure it out.
You're the lucha expert.
Yeah, but yeah, it's hard to remember some of this stuff because it's been so long ago. But yeah, there was one of them left, and I can't remember who it was off the top of my head. But yeah, there was a fight that 2 weeks later after all this went down. So, but yeah, who and Tugger was a fucking nut job too. You know, this is almost two years after the XPW stuff. And to Hoobie's credit, he's definitely cleaned up, and he's become a pretty successful DJ in Mexico and stuff like that.
Maybe that is amazing.
Incidents that it took getting away from wrestling for the most part to clean up. Incredible.
Yeah, he wrestles every now and then, but it's mainly just doing DJ stuff. So
I hope Special K goes to his gigs as a DJ.
What does it say about wrestling that being a club DJ is the nice, sober environment?
Yeah. Him and Cibernetico are doing some big thing at some bar tomorrow as part of a DJ wrestling type deal. So it's crazy. And Monty Brown, this is Monty Brown's first big deal in TNA. He was still wearing his New England Patriots jersey at this time period, so he's about to get the big push. That's another guy, you know.
He could have been a huge star. I still think he could have been a huge star.
Yeah, definitely. Of course, he went to WWE and ECW as Marcus Corbin and stuff like that. But yeah, Monty Brown had it. He had something to him.
Yeah, and then, you know what? Credit to him as a human being, though. Whatever happened with his sister personally, where he had to raise her kids, he left WWE and told them what happened. Left WWE. He never went back to wrestling. Seems like a solid guy. I mean, good for him.
And yeah, thing about this show is we got to talk about ICP real quick. One thing I didn't mention was ICP was at this time period in TNA, they were like the big draw. And
that's right, live at least.
Live. I mean, it was Juggalo Central, even though they were the heels. And the story goes that this was the second show taped on that evening. And the Juggalos got so tired that they left. Like 35% of them left. So,
That was the story of every show. So, and this happened a lot around this time. There was their ROH match. What happened was that you would have like a large group of ICP fans falling behind their tour bus in their own bus.
Yeah,
something like that. And if ICP went to had a match on a wrestling show, they'd go watch the one match and then leave. But promotions would use them though, because you all of a sudden you'd sell like 20, 25, 30, whatever more tickets. And by and large, you also didn't have to deal with Juggalos being at the show for more than one match.
Well, but the other thing too, it's not like, I mean, because a lot of Jugglers are wrestling fans independent of actual, like, of ICP itself. I think it's very
not
likely
as many
that the
as
meth
you'd
just
wore. No, not as many.
I think it's likely that the meth and the whippets just wore off and they had to go do some more in the van to get fired up for the next part of the taping.
Hilarious. Oh, man. What an era this was. Wow. Let's plug time here. Dylan, what do you got to plug this evening?
You know what? Not really much of anything. I'm still pretty consistently doing the Talking Week or Talking Sheet midweek shows over at SheetSandwich.com. Dave Musgrave and I actually talked today, and I think we're going to record an episode of Wrestling Culture, the first one in a long time, maybe even this weekend, so it might be out by the time this show is out. Other than that, you can follow me on Twitter at Dylan Waco. That's DylanWaco.
And, of course, I'm on that Talking Sheet midweek show with you on a regular basis, which I'll talk about after Bix gets through with his plugs. Bix.
Yes, you are on the Talking Sheet midweek show, Dylan.
That's right.
Okay. So this week, obviously, I've been covering a lot of the Hogan trial stuff, you know, daily stuff at sescoops.com or sescoops, as all of our friends like to call it now. Plus, I had something in Figure Four Weekly, going to have something again this week. Although this week I should also have my review of EA Sports UFC 2 for anyone who cares about that. So check that out in Figure Four Weekly as well. 605, the Super Podcast. Quite the show this week. We've got a special extended Dennis of the Week, part one of our talk with Donnie B, a.k.a. the twin brother of Nova, but please don't hold that against him. We've got
something. Great episode this week.
Oh, thank you. Oh, so would you say, though, that is the best wrestling podcast you have heard this year so far?
You know what? Since I've crushed you, I'm going to impugn our. I'm going to jump in. I will say that actually, 605 might be. If I was voting in the Sheeties today, it might be my pick for podcast. No disrespect to this show, no disrespect to Exile, no disrespect to Talking Sheet or any of the other podcasts out there. It might be my pick for podcast of the year right now.
Well, then. We also, you know, we talk about Lord James Blears a little bit, but thank you, seriously. We Buzz Sawyer's wrestling school, including a video of him acting kind of normal at his wrestling school. Brian reads an article titled Confessions of a Ring Rat with a famous Australian rat. And the whole thing takes quite the turn in more ways than one. A lot of good feedback for this episode, so check that out at 605pod.com and on iTunes. And I guess is that it for this week? Yeah, I guess so. Follow me on Twitter at David Bix, of course. I'll plug the Amazon thing again just so Chris doesn't have to. For us, if you want to support the show and you buy stuff at Amazon, go to tinyurl.com/BTSAmazon. When you add stuff to your cart after going to our Amazon link, then we get our little kickback. And yes, it's only if you add something to the cart after you go there. So if you have stuff already in your cart and you're like, hey, I want to help, you have to remove the stuff from your cart before adding it back. Yes, I know. So yeah, I guess that's it. Chris, what do you have going?
Well, Talking Sheet midweek, as was mentioned, me and Dylan was on this past show and talking about all kinds of good stuff going on. Let's see here. Exile on Bad Street, of course, the last one with Bo James about Continental. Huge hit. And from what I understand, last night, the Armstrong family listened to it. So we'll see how that goes in the future. But that's good to know that.
Did they listen to it as a unit?
I know Scott definitely listened to it, and Bob was supposed to listen to it as well. So there you go.
My dream is that they sat around like a fire and listened to it together.
They sat on Armstrong Avenue out there, and where Bob did his workouts at in the garage. But I'm so excited for the next part of that show, because we're gonna have, hopefully Carl will be on with us on that one, and that's gonna cover a great year of Continental, the 86-87. So can't wait for that one. That's gonna be recorded in a few weeks as I'm trying to space it out a little bit. Between the Sheets, of course, every Monday. Don't know what next week's gonna be yet. I'll try to get that figured out sometime this week after I get back from my little vacation. And other than that, not a whole lot going on right now. So I thank Dylan for being on with us tonight, doing this first show of the 2000s. Bix, of course, you are the rock of the show as my co-host. Thank you for everything that you do.
Like what?
And this is Chris saying so long from the Peach State of Georgia.
necessity.